Surely. Chapter 1. Levitical. Of late years an abundant shower of curates has fallen upon the north of England. They lie very thick on the hills, every parish has one or more of them, they are young enough to be very active, and ought to be doing a great deal of good. But not of late years are we about to speak, we are going back to the beginning of this century. Late years, present years are dusty, sunburnt, hot, arid. We will evade the noon, forget it in siesta, pass the midday in slumber, and dream of dawn. If you think, from this prelude, that anything like a romance is preparing for you, reader, you never were more mistaken. Do you anticipate sentiment, and poetry, and reverie? Do you expect passion, and stimulus, and melodrama? Calm your expectations, reduce them to a lowly standard. Something real, cool, and solid lies before you, something unromantic as Monday morning, when all who have work wake with the consciousness that they must rise and betake themselves thereto. It is not positively affirmed that you shall not have a taste of the exciting, perhaps towards the middle and close of the meal, but it is resolved that the first dish set upon the table shall be one that a Catholic, even an Anglo-Catholic, might eat on Good Friday and Passion Week. It shall be cold lentils and vinegar without oil, it shall be unleavened bread with bitter herbs, and no roast lamb. Of late years, I say, an abundant shower of curates has fallen upon the north of England, but in 1811-12 that affluent rain had not descended. Curates were scarce then, there was no pastoral aid, no additional curates' society to stretch a helping hand to worn-out old rectors and incumbents, and give them the wherewithal to pay a vigorous young colleague from Oxford or Cambridge. The present successors of the apostles, disciples of Dr. Pusey and tools of the propaganda, were at that time being hatched under cradle blankets, or undergoing regeneration by nursery baptism and wash-hand basins. You could not have guessed by looking at any one of them that the Italian iron double frills of its net cap surrounded the brows of a preordained, specially sanctified successor of St. Paul, St. Peter, or St. John, nor could you have foreseen in the folds of its long nightgown the white surplice in which it was hereafter cruelly to exercise the souls of its parishioners, and strangely to nonplus its old-fashioned vicar by flourishing aloft in a pulpit the shirt-like raiment which had never before waved higher than the reading desk. Yet even in those days of scarcity there were curates, the precious plant was rare, but it might be found. A certain favored district in the West Riding of Yorkshire could boast three rods of Arran blossoming within a circuit of 20 miles. You shall see them, reader. Step into this neat garden house on the skirts of Winbury, walk forward into the little parlor. There they are at dinner. Allow me to introduce them to you, Mr. Dunn, curate of Winbury, Mr. Malone, curate of Briarfield, Mr. Sweeting, curate of Nunnally. These are Mr. Dunn's lodgings, being the habitation of one John Gale, a small clothier. Mr. Dunn has kindly invited his brethren to regale with him. You and I will join the party, see what is to be seen, and hear what is to be heard. At present, however, they are only eating, and while they eat we will talk aside. These gentlemen are in the bloom of youth, they possess all the activity of that interesting age and activity which their moping old vicars would fain turn into the channel of their pastoral duties, often expressing a wish to see it expended in a diligent superintendence of the schools, and in frequent visits to the sick of their respective parishes. But the youthful Levites feel this to be dull work. They prefer lavishing their energies on a course of proceeding which, though to other eyes it appear more heavy with ennui, more cursed with monotony, than the toil of the weaver at his loom, seems to yield them an unfailing supply of enjoyment and occupation. I allude to a rushing backwards and forwards, amongst themselves, to and from their respective lodgings, not a round, but a triangle of visits, which they keep up all the year through, in winter, spring, summer, and autumn. Season and weather make no difference, with unintelligible zeal they dare snow and hail, wind and rain, mire and dust, to go and dine, or drink tea, or sup with each other. What attracts them it would be difficult to say. It is not friendship, for whenever they meet they quarrel. It is not religion, the thing is never named amongst them, theology they may discuss occasionally, but piety never. It is not the love of eating and drinking, each might have as good a joint and pudding, tea as potent, and toast as succulent, at his own lodgings, as is served to him at his brother's. Mrs. Gale, Mrs. Hogg, and Mrs. Whip, their respective landladies, affirm that it is just for naught else but to give folk trouble. By folk the good ladies of course mean themselves, for indeed they are kept in a continual fry by this system of mutual invasion. Mr. Dunn and his guests, as I have said, are at dinner. Mrs. Gale waits on them, but a spark of the hot kitchen fire is in her eye. She considers that the privilege of inviting a friend to a meal occasionally, without additional charge, A privilege included in the terms on which she lets her lodgings has been quite sufficiently exercised of late. The present week is yet but a Thursday, and on Monday Mr. Malone, the curate of Briarfield, came to breakfast and stayed dinner. On Tuesday Mr. Malone and Mr. Sweeting of Nonaly came to tea, remained to supper, occupied the spare bed, and favored her with their company to breakfast on Wednesday morning. Now, on Thursday, they are both here at dinner, and she is almost certain they will stay all night. Qu'en est-tro, she would say, if she could speak French. Mr. Sweeting is mincing the slice of roast beef on his plate, and complaining that it is very tough. Mr. Dunn says the beer is flat. That is the worst of it. If they would only be civil, Mrs. Gale wouldn't mind it so much. If they would only seem satisfied with what they get, she wouldn't care. But these young parsons is so high and so scornful, they set everybody beneath their feet. They treat her with less than civility, just because she doesn't keep a servant, but does the work of the house herself, as her mother did for her. Then they are always speaking against Yorkshire ways and Yorkshire folk, and by that very token Mrs. Gale does not believe one of them to be a real gentleman, or come of gentle kin. The old parsons is worth the whole lump of college lads. They know what belongs to good manners, and is kind to high and low. More bread, cries Mr. Malone, in a tone which, though prolonged but to utter two syllables, proclaims him at once a native of the land of shamrocks and potatoes. Mrs. Gale hates Mr. Malone more than either of the other two, but she fears him also, for he is a tall, strongly built personage, with real Irish legs and arms, and a face as genuinely national, not the Malaysian face, not Daniel O'Connell's style, but the high-featured, North American Indian sort of visage, which belongs to a certain class of the Irish gentry, and has a petrified and proud look, better suited to the owner of an estate of slaves than to the landlord of a free peasantry. Mr. Malone's father termed himself a gentleman. He was poor and in debt, and besottedly arrogant, and his son was like him. Mrs. Gale offered the loaf. "Cut it, woman," said her guest, and the woman cut it accordingly. Had she followed her inclinations, she would have cut the parson also. Her Yorkshire soul revolted absolutely from his manner of command. The curates had good appetites, and while the beef was tough, they ate a great deal of it. They swallowed, too, a tolerable allowance of the flat beer, while a dish of Yorkshire pudding, and two tureens of vegetables, disappeared like leaves before locusts. The cheese, too, received distinguished marks of their attention, and a spice cake, which followed by way of dessert, vanished like a vision, and was no more found. Its elegy was chanted in the kitchen by Abraham, Mrs. Gale's son and heir, a youth of 6 summers. He had reckoned upon the reversion thereof, and when his mother brought down the empty platter, he lifted up his voice and wept sore. The curates, meantime, sat and sipped their wine, a liquor of unpretending vintage, moderately enjoyed. Mr. Malone, indeed, would much rather have had whiskey, but Mr. Dunn, being an Englishman, did not keep the beverage. While they sipped, they argued, not on politics, nor on philosophy, nor on literature. These topics were now, as ever, totally without interest for them, not even on theology, practical or doctrinal, but on minute points of ecclesiastical discipline, frivolities which seemed empty as bubbles to all save themselves. Mr. Malone, who contrived to secure 2 glasses of wine, when his brethren contented themselves with one, waxed by degrees hilarious after his fashion, that is, he grew a little insolent, said rude things in a hectoring tone, and laughed clamorously at his own brilliancy. Each of his companions became in turn his butt. Malone had a stock of jokes at their service, which he was accustomed to serve up regularly on convivial occasions like the present, seldom varying his wit, for which, indeed, there was no necessity, as he never appeared to consider himself monotonous, and did not at all care what others thought. Mr. Dunn he favored with hints about his extreme eagerness, allusions to his turned-up nose, cutting sarcasms on a certain threadbare chocolates or two which that gentleman was accustomed to sport whenever it rained or seemed likely to rain, and criticisms on a choice set of Cockney phrases and modes of pronunciation, Mr. Dunn's own property, and certainly deserving of remark for the elegance and finish they communicated to his style. Mr. Sweeting was bantered about his stature. He was a little man, a mere boy in height and breadth compared with the athletic Malone. Rallied on his musical accomplishments, he played the flute and sang hymns like a seraph. Some young ladies of his parish thought, sneered at as the lady's pet, teased about his mama and sisters, for whom poor Mr. Sweeting had some lingering regard, and of whom he was foolish enough now and then to speak in the presence of the priestly Patty, from whose anatomy the bowels of natural affection had somehow been emitted. The victims met these attacks each in his own way, Mr. Dunn with a stilted self-complacency and half-sullen phlegm, the sole props of his otherwise somewhat rickety dignity, Mr. Sweeting with the indifference of a light, easy disposition, which never professed to have any dignity to maintain. When Malone's raillery became rather too offensive, which it soon did, they joined, in an attempt to turn the tables on him by asking him how many boys had shouted Irish Peter after him as he came along the road that day. Malone's name was Peter, the Reverend Peter Augustus Malone, requesting to be informed whether it was the mode in Ireland for clergymen to carry loaded pistols in their pockets, and a shillelagh in their hands, when they made pastoral visits, inquiring the signification of such words as Baile, Fearum, Helum, Storum. So Mr. Malone invariably pronounced Veil, Firm, Helm, Storm, and employing such other methods of retaliation as the innate refinement of their minds suggested. This, of course, would not do. Malone, being neither good-natured nor phlegmatic, was presently in a towering passion. He vociferated, gesticulated, Dunn and Sweeting laughed. He reviled them as Saxons and snobs at the very top pitch of his high Celtic voice. They taunted him with being the native of a conquered land. He menaced rebellion in the name of his country, vented bitter hatred against English rule. They spoke of rags, beggary, and pestilence. The little parlor was in an uproar. You would have thought a duel must follow such virulent abuse. It seemed a wonder that Mr. and Mrs. Gale did not take alarm at the noise, and sent for a constable to keep the peace. But they were accustomed to such demonstrations. They well knew that the curates never dined or took tea together without a little exercise of the sort, and were quite easy as to consequences, knowing that these clerical quarrels were as harmless as they were noisy, that they resulted in nothing, and that, on whatever terms the curates might part tonight, they would be sure to meet the best friends in the world tomorrow morning. As the worthy pair were sitting by their kitchen fire, listening to the repeated and sonorous contact of Malone's fist with the mahogany plane of the parlor table, and to the consequent start and jingle of decanters and glasses following each assault, to the mocking laughter of the allied English disputants, and the stuttering declamation of the isolated Hibernian as they thus sat, a foot was heard on the outer doorstep, and the knocker quivered to a sharp appeal. Mr. Gale went and opened. "Whom have you upstairs in the parlor?" asked a voice, a rather remarkable voice, nasal in tone, abrupt in utterance. "Oh, Mr. Helstone, is it you, sir? I could hardly see you for the darkness, it is so soon dark now. Will you walk in, sir? I want to know first whether it is worth my while walking in. Whom have you upstairs?"
"The curates, sir."
"What? All of them?"
"Yes, sir."
"Been dining here?"
"Yes, sir."
"That will do." With these words, a person entered, a middle-aged man, in black. He walked straight across the kitchen to an inner door, opened it, inclined his head forward, and stood listening. There was something to listen to, for the noise above was just then louder than ever. "Hey!" he ejaculated to himself, then turning to Mr. Gale, "have you often this sort of work?" Mr. Gale had been a church warden, and was indulgent to the clergy.
"They're young, you know, sir, they're young," said he deprecatingly.
"Young. They want caning. Bad boys, bad boys. And if you were a dissenter, John Gale, instead of being a good churchman, they'd do the life, they'd expose themselves, but I'll—" By way of finish to this sentence, he passed through the inner door, drew it after him, and mounted the stair. Again he listened a few minutes when he arrived at the upper room. Making entrance without warning, he stood before the curates. And they were silent, they were transfixed, and so was the invader. He, a personage short of stature, but straight of port, and bearing on broad shoulders a hawk's head, beak, and eye, the whole surmounted by a rehoboam, or shovel hat, which he did not seem to think it necessary to lift or remove before the presence in which he then stood, he folded his arms on his chest and surveyed his young friends, if friends they were, much at his leisure.
"What?"
he began, delivering his words in a voice no longer nasal, but deep, more than deep, a voice made purposely hollow and cavernous. "What? Has the miracle of Pentecost been renewed? Have the cloven tongues come down again? Where are they? The sound filled the whole house just now. I heard the 17 languages in full action, Parthians, and Medes, and Elamites, the dwellers in Mesopotamia, and in Judea, and Cappadocia, in Pontus and Asia, Phrygia and Pamphylia, in Egypt and in the parts of Libya about Cyrene, strangers of Rome, Jews and proselytes, Cretes and Arabians. Every one of these must have had its representative in this room 2 minutes since."
"I beg your pardon, Mr. Helstone," began Mr. Dunn, "take a seat, pray, sir. Have a glass of wine?" His civilities received no answer. The falcon in the black coat proceeded, dash. What do I talk about the gift of tongues? Gift, indeed. I mistook the chapter, and book, and testament gospel for law, Acts for Genesis, the city of Jerusalem for the plain of Shinar. It was no gift but the confusion of tongues which has gabbled me deaf as a post. You, apostles? What? You three? Certainly not, three presumptuous Babylonish masons, neither more nor less. I assure you, sir, we were only having a little chat together over a glass of wine after a friendly dinner settling the dissenters.
Oh. Settling the dissenters, were you? Was Malone settling the dissenters?
It sounded to me much more like settling his co-apostles. You were quarreling together, making almost as much noise you three alone as Moses Bearclaw, the preaching tailor, and all his hearers are making in the Methodist chapel down yonder, where they are in the thick of a revival. I know whose fault it is. It is yours, Malone.
Mine, sir?
Yours, sir. Dunn and Sweeting were quiet before you came, and would be quiet if you were gone. I wish, when you crossed the channel, you had left your Irish habits behind you. Dublin student ways won't do here. The proceedings which might pass unnoticed in a wild bog and mountain district in Connaught will, in a decent English parish, bring disgrace on those who indulge in them, and, what is far worse, on the sacred institution of which they are merely the humble appendages. There was a certain dignity in the little elderly gentleman's manner of rebuking these youths, though it was not, perhaps, quite the dignity most appropriate to the occasion. Mr. Helstone, standing straight as a ramrod, looking keen as a kite, presented, despite his clerical hat, black coat, and gaiters, more the air of a veteran officer chiding his subalterns than of a venerable priest exhorting his sons in the faith. Gospel mildness, apostolic benignity, never seemed to have breathed their influence over that keen brown visage, but firmness had fixed the features, and sagacity had carved her own lines about them. I met Supalaho, he continued, plodding through the mud this wet night, going to preach at Mildy in opposition shop. As I told you, I heard Bearclaw bellowing in the midst of a conventicle like a possessed bull, and I find you, gentlemen, carrying over your half-pint of muddy port wine, and scolding like angry old women. No wonder Supalaho should have dipped 16 adult converts in a day which he did a fortnight since, no wonder Bearclaw, scamp and hypocrite as he is, should attract all the weaver girls in their flowers and ribbons, to witness how much harder are his knuckles than the wooden brim of his tub, as little wonder that you, when you are left to yourselves, without your rectors myself, and Hall, and Boltby to back you, should too often perform the holy service of our church to bare walls, and read your bit of a dry discourse to the clerk, and the organist, and the beadle. But enough of the subject. I came to see Malone. I have an errand unto thee, O captain.
What is it?
Inquired Malone discontentedly. There can be no funeral to take at this time of day. Have you any arms about you?
Arms, sir?
Yes, and legs. And he advanced the mighty members.
Bah.
Weapons I mean.
I have the pistols you gave me yourself.
I never part with them. I lay them ready cocked on a chair by my bedside at night. I have my blackthorn.
Very good.
Will you go to Hollow's Mill?
What is stirring at Hollow's Mill?
Nothing as yet, nor perhaps will be, but Moore is alone there. He has sent all the workmen he can trust to Stillbro. There are only two women left about the place. It would be a nice opportunity for any of his well-wishers to pay him a visit, if they knew how straight the path was made before them.
I am none of his well-wishers, sir. I don't care for him.
So, Malone, you are afraid.
You know me better than that. If I really thought there was a chance of a row I would go, but Moore is a strange, shy man, whom I never pretend to understand, and for the sake of his sweet company only I would not stir a step. But there is a chance of a row, if a positive riot does not take place of which, indeed, I see no signs yet it is unlikely this night will pass quite tranquilly. You know Moore has resolved to have new machinery, and he expects two wagon loads of frames and shears from Stillbro this evening. Scott, the overlooker, and a few picked men are gone to fetch them. They will bring them in safely and quietly enough, sir.
Moore says so, and affirms he wants nobody. Someone, however, he must have, if it were only to bear evidence in case anything should happen. I call him very careless. He sits in the counting house with the shutters unclosed, he goes out here and there after dark, wanders right up the hollow, down Fieldhead Lane, among the plantations, just as if he were the darling of the neighborhood, or being, as he is, its detestation bore a charmed life, as they say in tale books. He takes no warning from the fate of Pearson, nor from that of Armitachat, one in his own house and the other on the moor. But he should take warning, sir, and use precautions too, interposed Mr. Sweeting, and I think he would if he heard what I heard the other day.
What did you hear, Davy?
You know Mike Hartley, sir?
The antinomian weaver?
Yes. When Mike has been drinking for a few weeks together, he generally winds up by a visit to Nurnally Vicarage, to tell Mr. Hall a piece of his mind about his sermons, to denounce the horrible tendency of his doctrine of works, and warn him that he and all his hearers are sitting in outer darkness.
Well, that has nothing to do with Moore.
Besides being an antinomian, he is a violent Jacobin and leveler, sir.
I know.
When he is very drunk, his mind is always running on regicide. Mike is not unacquainted with history, and it is rich to hear him going over the list of tyrants of whom, as he says, the revenger of blood has obtained satisfaction. The fellow exults strangely in murder done on crowned heads or on any head for political reasons. I have already heard it hinted that he seems to have a queer hankering after more.
Is that what you allude to, Sweeting?
You use the proper term, sir. Mr. Hall thinks Mike has no personal hatred of Moore. Mike says he even likes to talk to him and run after him, but he has a hankering that Moore should be made an example of. He was extolling him to Mr. Hall the other day as the mill owner with the most brains in Yorkshire, and for that reason he affirms Moore should be chosen as a sacrifice, an oblation of a sweet savor.
Is Mike Hartley in his right mind, do you think, sir?
Inquired Sweeting simply.
Can't tell, Davy.
He may be crazed, or he may be only crafty, or perhaps a little of both.
He talks of seeing visions, sir.
Eh? He is a very Ezekiel or Daniel for visions. He came just when I was going to bed last Friday night to describe one that had been revealed to him in Nurnally Park that very afternoon.
Tell it, sir.
What was it?
Urged Sweeting.
Davy, thou hast an enormous organ of wonder in thy cranium. Malone, you see, has none. Neither murders nor visions interest him. See what a big vacant soph he looks at this moment.
Soph?
Who was soph, sir?
I thought you would not know.
You may find it out. It is biblical. I know nothing more of him than his name and race, but from a boy upwards I have always attached a personality to soph. Depend on it he was honest, heavy, and luckless. He met his end at God by the hand of Sibichai.
But the vision, sir?
Davy, thou shalt hear. Dunn is biting his nails, and Malone yawning, so I will tell it but to thee. Mike is out of work, like many others, unfortunately. Mr. Graham, Sir Philip Nurnally's steward, gave him a job about the priory. According to his account, Mike was busy hedging rather late in the afternoon, but before dark, when he heard what he thought was a band at a distance bugles, fifes, and the sound of a trumpet, it came from the forest, and he wondered that there should be music there. He looked up. All amongst the trees he saw moving objects, red, like poppies, or white, like may blossom. The wood was full of them, they poured out and filled the park. He then perceived they were soldiers thousands and tens of thousands, but they made no more noise than a swarm of midges on a summer evening. They formed in order, he affirmed, and marched, regiment after regiment, across the park. He followed them to Nurnally Common, the music still played soft and distant. On the common he watched them go through a number of evolutions. A man clothed in scarlet stood in the center and directed them. They extended, he declared, over 50 acres. They were in sight half an hour, then they marched away quite silently. The whole time he heard neither voice nor tread, nothing but the faint music playing a solemn march.
Where did they go, sir?
Towards Briarfield. Mike followed them. They seemed passing Fieldhead, when a column of smoke, such as might be vomited by a park of artillery, spread noiseless over the fields, the road, the common, and rolled, he said, blue and dim, to his very feet. As it cleared away he looked again for the soldiers, but they were vanished, he saw them no more. Mike, like a wise Daniel as he is, not only rehearsed the vision but gave the interpretation thereof. It signifies, he intimated, bloodshed and civil conflict.
Do you credit it, sir?
Asked Sweeting.
Do you, Davy?
But come, Malone, why are you not off?
I am rather surprised, sir, you did not stay with Moore yourself. You like this kind of thing.
So I should have done, had I not unfortunately happened to engage Boltby to sup with me on his way home from the Bible Society meeting at Nunnally. I promised to send you as my substitute, for which, by the by, he did not thank me. He would much rather have had me than you, Peter. Should there be any real need of help, I shall join you. The mill bell will give warning.
Meantime, go unless, turning suddenly to Messrs. Sweeting and Dunn, unless Davy Sweeting or Joseph Dunn prefers going. What do you say, gentlemen? The commission is an honorable one, not without the seasoning of a little real peril, for the country is in a queer state, as you all know, and Moore and his mill and his machinery are held in sufficient odium. There are chivalric sentiments, there is high beating courage, under those waistcoats of yours, I doubt not. Perhaps I am too partial to my favorite Peter. Little David shall be the champion, or spotless Joseph. Malone, you are but a great floundering Saul after all, good only to lend your armor. Out with your firearms, fetch your shillelagh. It is there in the corner. With a significant grin Malone produced his pistols, offering one to each of his brethren. They were not readily seized on. With graceful modesty each gentleman retired a step from the presented weapon. I never touch them. I never did touch anything of the kind, said Mr. Dunn. I am almost a stranger to Mr. Moore, murmured Sweeting. If you never touched a pistol, try the feel of it now, great satrap of Egypt. As to the little minstrel, he probably prefers encountering the Philistines with no other weapon than his flute. Get their hats, Peter. They'll both of 'em go. No, sir, no, Mr. Halstone. My mother wouldn't like it, pleaded Sweeting. And I make it a rule never to get mixed up in affairs of the kind, observed Dunn. Halstone smiled sardonically, Malone laughed a horse laugh. He then replaced his arms, took his hat and cudgel, and saying that he never felt more in tune for a shindy in his life, and that he wished a score of greasy cloth dressers might beat up Moore's quarters that night, he made his exit, clearing the stairs at a stride or two, and making the house shake with the bang of the front door behind him. Chapter 2. The Wagons. The evening was pitch dark, star and moon were quenched in gray rain clouds, gray they would have been by day, by night they looked sable. Malone was not a man given to close observation of nature, her changes passed, for the most part, unnoticed by him. He could walk miles on the most varying April day and never see the beautiful dallying of earth and heaven, never mark when a sunbeam kissed the hilltops, making them smile clear in green light, or when a shower wept over them, hiding their crests with the low-hanging, disheveled tresses of a cloud. He did not, therefore, care to contrast the sky as it now appeared, a muffled, streaming vault, all black, save where, towards the east, the furnaces of Stillbrough Ironworks threw a tremulous lurid shimmer on the horizon with the same sky on an unclouded frosty night. He did not trouble himself to ask where the constellations and the planets were gone, or to regret the black-blue serenity of the air ocean which those white islets stud, and which another ocean, of heavier and denser element, now rolled below and concealed. He just doggedly pursued his way, leaning a little forward as he walked, and wearing his hat on the back of his head, as his Irish manner was. Tramp, tramp, he went along the causeway, where the road boasted the privilege of such an accommodation, splash, splash, through the mire-filled cart ruts, where the flags were exchanged for soft mud. He looked but for certain landmarks, the spire of Briarfield Church, farther on, the lights of Red House. This was an inn, and when he reached it, the glow of a fire through a half-curtain window, a vision of glasses on a round table, and of revelers on an oaken settle, had nearly drawn aside the curate from his course. He thought longingly of a tumbler of whiskey and water. In a strange place he would instantly have realized the dream, but the company assembled in that kitchen were Mr. Helstone's own parishioners, they all knew him. He sighed, and passed on. The high road was now to be quitted, as the remaining distance to Hallow's Mill might be considerably reduced by a short cut across fields. These fields were level and monotonous. Malone took a direct course through them, jumping hedge and wall. He passed but one building here, and that seemed large and hall-like, though irregular. You could see a high gable, then a long front, then a low gable, then a thick, lofty stack of chimneys. There were some trees behind it. It was dark, not a candle shone from any window. It was absolutely still, the rain running from the eaves, and the rather wild but very low whistle of the wind round the chimneys and through the boughs were the sole sounds in its neighborhood. This building passed, the fields, hitherto flat, declined in a rapid ascent. Evidently a vale lay below, through which you could hear the water run. One light glimmered in the depth. For that beacon Malone stared. He came to a little white house. You could see it was white even through this dense darkness, and knocked at the door. A fresh-faced servant opened it. By the candle she held was revealed a narrow passage, terminating in a narrow stair. Two doors covered with crimson baize, a strip of crimson carpet down the steps, contrasted with light-colored walls and white floor, made the little interior look clean and fresh. Mr. Moore is at home, I suppose?
Yes, sir, but he is not in.
Not in?
Where is he then?
At the mill in the counting house.
Here one of the crimson doors opened.
Are the wagons come, Sarah?
Asked a female voice, and a female head at the same time was apparent. It might not be the head of a goddess. Indeed, a screw of curl paper on each side the temples quite forbade that supposition, but neither was it the head of a gorgon, yet Malone seemed to take it in the latter light. Big as he was, he shrank bashfully back into the rain at the view thereof, and saying, "I'll go to him," hurried in seeming trepidation down a short lane, across an obscure yard, towards a huge black mill. The work hours were over, the hands were gone. The machinery was at rest, the mill shut up. Malone walked round it. Somewhere in its great sooty flank he found another chink of light. He knocked at another door, using for the purpose the thick end of his shillila, with which he beat a rousing tattoo. A key turned, the door unclosed.
Is it Joe Scott?
What news of the wagons, Joe?
No, it's myself. Mr. Helstone would send me.
Oh. Mr. Malone. The voice in uttering this name had the slightest possible cadence of disappointment. After a moment's pause it continued, politely but a little formally, dash. I beg you will come in, Mr. Malone. I regret extremely Mr. Helstone should have thought it necessary to trouble you so far. There was no necessity, I told him so, and on such a night, but walk forwards. Through a dark apartment, of aspect undistinguishable, Malone followed the speaker into a light and bright room within, very light and bright indeed it seemed to eyes which, for the last hour, had been striving to penetrate the double darkness of night and fog, but except for its excellent fire, and for a lamp of elegant design and vivid luster burning on a table, it was a very plain place. The boarded floor was carpetless, the three or four stiff-backed, green-painted chairs seemed once to have furnished the kitchen of some farmhouse, a desk of strong, solid formation, the table aforesaid, and some framed sheets on the stone-colored walls, bearing plans for building, for gardening, designs of machinery, etc., completed the furniture of the place. Plain as it was, it seemed to satisfy Malone, who, when he had removed and hung up his wet surtout and hat, drew one of the rheumatic-looking chairs to the hearth, and set his knees almost within the bars of the red grate. Comfortable quarters you have here, Mr. Moore, and all snug to yourself.
Yes, but my sister would be glad to see you, if you would prefer stepping into the house.
Oh no. The ladies are best alone, I never was a ladies' man. You don't mistake me for my friend Sweeting, do you, Mr. Moore?
Sweeting.
Which of them is that? The gentleman in the chocolate overcoat, or the little gentleman?
The little one he of Nonnally, the cavalier of the Mrs. Sykes, with the whole six of whom he is in love, ha.
Ha?
Better be generally in love with all than specially with one, I should think, in that quarter. But he is specially in love with one besides, for when I and Dunn urged him to make a choice amongst the fair Betty, he named which, do you think?
With a queer, quiet smile Mr. Moore replied, Dora, of course, or Harriet.
Ha? Ha? You've an excellent guess. But what made you hit on those two?
Because they are the tallest, the handsomest, and Dora, at least, is the stoutest, and as your friend Mr. Sweeting is but a little slight figure, I concluded that, according to a frequent rule in such cases, he preferred his contrast.
You are right, Dora, it is. But he has no chance, has he, Moore?
What has Mr. Sweeting besides his curacy? This question seemed to tickle Malone amazingly. He laughed for full 3 minutes before he answered it.
What has Sweeting?
Why, David has his harp, or flute, which comes to the same thing. He has a sort of pinchbeck watch, ditto, ring, ditto, eyeglass. That's what he has.
How would he propose to keep Miss Sykes in gowns only?
Ha? Ha? Excellent. I'll ask him that next time I see him. I'll roast him for his presumption. But no doubt he expects old Christopher Sykes would do something handsome. He is rich, is he not? They live in a large house. Sykes carries on an extensive concern. Therefore he must be wealthy, eh? Therefore he must have plenty to do with his wealth, and in these times would be about as likely to think of drawing money from the business to give dowries to his daughters as I should be to dream of pulling down the cottage there, and constructing on its ruins a house as large as Fieldhead. Do you know what I heard, Moore, the other day?
No.
Perhaps that I was about to effect some such change. Your Briarfield gossips are capable of saying that or sillier things. That you were going to take Fieldhead on a lease, I thought it looked a dismal place, by the by, tonight, as I passed it,
and that it was your intention to settle a Miss Sykes there as mistress to be married, in short, ha.
Ha?
Now, which is it?
Dora, I am sure. You said she was the handsomest.
I wonder how often it has been settled that I was to be married since I came to Briarfield. They have assigned me every marriageable single woman by turns in the district. Now it was the two Misses Wins, first the dark, then the light one, now the red-haired Miss Armitage, then the mature Anne Pearson. At present you throw on my shoulders all the tribe of the Mrs. Sykes. On what grounds this gossip rests God knows. I visit nowhere, I seek female society about as assiduously as you do, Mr. Malone. If ever I go to Winbury, it is only to give Sykes or Pearson a call in their counting house, where our discussions run on other topics than matrimony, and our thoughts are occupied with other things than courtships, establishments, dowries. The cloth we can't sell, the hands we can't employ, the mills we can't run, the perverse course of events generally, which we cannot alter, fill our hearts, I take it, pretty well at present, to the tolerably complete exclusion of such figments as lovemaking, etc. I go along with you completely, more. If there is one notion I hate more than another, it is that of marriage. I mean marriage in the vulgar weak sense, as a mere matter of sentiment, two beggarly fools agreeing to unite their indigence by some fantastic tie of feeling. Humbug. But an advantageous connection, such as can be formed in consonance with dignity of views and permanency of solid interests, is not so bad, eh?
No, responded Moore, in an absent manner. The subject seemed to have no interest for him, he did not pursue it. After sitting for some time gazing at the fire with a preoccupied air, he suddenly turned his head.
Hark! Said he. Did you hear wheels? Rising, he went to the window, opened it, and listened. He soon closed it. It is only the sound of the wind rising, he remarked, and the rivulet a little swollen, rushing down the hollow. I expected those wagons at 6, it is near 9 now.
Seriously, do you suppose that the putting up of this new machinery will bring you into danger? Inquired Malone.
Helstone seems to think it will. I only wish the machines, the frames, were safe here, and lodged within the walls of this mill. Once put up, I defy the frame breakers. Let them only pay me a visit and take the consequences. My mill is my castle.
One despises such low scoundrels, observed Malone, in a profound vein of reflection. I almost wish a party would call upon you tonight, but the road seemed extremely quiet as I came along. I saw nothing astir.
You came by the Red House?
Yes.
There would be nothing on that road. It is in the direction of Stillborough the risk lies.
And you think there is risk?
What these fellows have done to others they may do to me. There is only this difference, most of the manufacturers seem paralyzed when they are attacked. Sykes, for instance, when his dressing shop was set on fire and burned to the ground, when the cloth was torn from his tenters and left in shreds in the field, took no steps to discover or punish the miscreants, he gave up as tamely as a rabbit under the jaws of a ferret. Now I, if I know myself, should stand by my trade, my mill, and my machinery. Helstone says these three are your gods, that the orders in council are with you another name for the seven deadly sins, that Castlereagh is your antichrist, and the war party his legions.
Yes, I abhor all these things because they ruin me. They stand in my way. I cannot get on. I cannot execute my plans because of them. I see myself baffled at every turn by their untoward effects.
But you are rich and thriving, Moore?
I'm very rich in cloth I cannot sell. You should step into my warehouse yonder, and observe how it is piled to the roof with pieces. Rokes and Pearson are in the same condition. America used to be their market, but the orders in council have cut that off.
Malone did not seem prepared to carry on briskly a conversation of this sort. He began to knock the heels of his boots together, and to yawn.
And then to think, continued Mr. Moore, who seemed too much taken up with the current of his own thoughts to note the symptoms of his guest's ennui, to think that these ridiculous gossips of Winbury and Briarfield will keep pestering one about being married. As if there was nothing to be done in life but to pay attention, as they say, to some young lady, and then to go to church with her, and then to start on a bridal tour, and then to run through a round of visits, and then, I suppose, to be having a family.
Oh, quel diable amour! He broke off the aspiration into which he was launching with a certain energy, and added, more calmly, I believe women talk and think only of these things, and they naturally fancy men's minds similarly occupied.
Of course, assented Malone, but never mind them. And he whistled, looked impatiently round, and seemed to feel a great want of something. This time Moore caught and, it appeared, comprehended his demonstrations. "Mr. Malone," said he, "you must require refreshment after your wet walk. I forget hospitality."
"Not at all," rejoined Malone, but he looked as if the right nail was at last hit on the head, nevertheless. Moore rose and opened a cupboard.
"It is my fancy," said he, "to have every convenience within myself, and not to be dependent on the femininity in the cottage yonder for every mouthful I eat or every drop I drink. I often spend the evening and sup here alone, and sleep with Joe Scott in the mill. Sometimes I am my own watchman. I require little sleep, and it pleases me on a fine night to wander for an hour or two with my musket about the hollow. Mr. Malone, can you cook a mutton chop?
Try me. I've done it hundreds of times at college.
There's a dishful, then, and there's the gridiron. Turn them quickly. You know the secret of keeping the juices in?
Never fear me, you shall see. Hand a knife and fork, please."
The curate turned up his coat cuffs, and applied himself to the cookery with vigor. The manufacturer placed on the table plates, a loaf of bread, a black bottle, and two tumblers. He then produced a small copper kettle still from the same well-stored recess, his cupboard filled it with water from a large stone jar in a corner, set it on the fire beside the hissing gridiron, got lemons, sugar, and a small china punch bowl, but while he was brewing the punch a tap at the door called him away.
"Is it you, Sarah?"
"Yes, sir."
"Will you come to supper, please, sir?"
"No, I shall not be in tonight, I shall sleep in the mill.
So lock the doors, and tell your mistress to go to bed."
He returned. "You have your household in proper order," observed Malone approvingly, as, with his fine face ruddy as the embers over which he bent, he assiduously turned the mutton chops. "You are not under petticoat government, like poor Sweeting, a man few. How the fat spits! It has burnt my hand destined to be ruled by women. Now you and I, Mur, there's a fine brown one for you, and full of gravy. You and I will have no gray mares in our stables when we marry."
"I don't know, I never think about it. If the gray mare is handsome and tractable, why not?"
"The chops are done. Is the punch brewed?"
"There is a glassful. Taste it. When Joe Scott and his minions return they shall have a share of this, provided they bring home the frames intact."
Malone waxed very exultant over the supper. He laughed aloud at trifles, made bad jokes and applauded them himself, and, in short, grew unmeaningly noisy. His host, on the contrary, remained quiet as before. It is time, reader, that you should have some idea of the appearance of this same host. I must endeavor to sketch him as he sits at table. He is what you would probably call, at first view, rather a strange-looking man, for he is thin, dark, sallow, very foreign of aspect, with shadowy hair carelessly streaking his forehead. It appears that he spends but little time at his toilet, or he would arrange it with more taste. He seems unconscious that his features are fine, that they have a southern symmetry, clearness, regularity in their chiseling, nor does a spectator become aware of this advantage till he has examined him well, for an anxious countenance and a hollow, somewhat haggard, outline of face disturb the idea of beauty with one of care. His eyes are large, and grave, and gray, their expression is intent and meditative, rather searching than soft, rather thoughtful than genial. When he parts his lips in a smile, his physiognomy is agreeable, not that it is frank or cheerful even then, but you feel the influence of a certain sedate charm, suggestive, whether truly or delusively, of a considerate, perhaps a kind nature, of feelings that may wear well at home, patient, forbearing, possibly faithful feelings. He is still young, not more than 30, his stature is tall, his figure slender. His manner of speaking displeases. He has an outlandish accent, which, notwithstanding a studied carelessness of pronunciation and diction, grates on a British, and especially on a Yorkshire, air. Mr. Moore, indeed, was but half a Briton, and scarcely that. He came of a foreign ancestry by the mother's side, and was himself born and partly reared on a foreign soil. A hybrid in nature, it is probable he had a hybrid's feeling on many points. Patriotism for one, it is likely that he was unapt to attach himself to parties, to sex, even to climes and customs. It is not impossible that he had a tendency to isolate his individual person from any community amidst which his lot might temporarily happen to be thrown, and that he felt it to be his best wisdom to push the interests of Robert Sherard Moore, to the exclusion of philanthropic consideration for general interests, with which he regarded the said Sherard Moore as in a great measure disconnected. Trade was Mr. Moore's hereditary calling. The Gerards of Antwerp had been merchants for two centuries back. Once they had been wealthy merchants, but the uncertainties, the involvements, of business had come upon them. Disastrous speculations had loosened by degrees the foundations of their credit. The house had stood on a tottering base for a dozen years, and at last, in the shock of the French Revolution, it had rushed down a total ruin. In its fall was involved the English and Yorkshire firm of Moore, closely connected with the Antwerp house, and of which one of the partners, resident in Antwerp, Robert Moore, had married Hortense Gerard, with the prospect of his bride inheriting her father Constantin Gerard's share in the business. She inherited, as we have seen, but his share in the liabilities of the firm, and these liabilities, though duly set aside by a composition with creditors, some said her son Robert accepted, in his turn, as a legacy, and that he aspired one day to discharge them, and to rebuild the fallen house of Gerard and Moore on a scale at least equal to its former greatness. It was even supposed that he took by past circumstances much to heart, and if a childhood passed at the side of a saturnine mother, under foreboding of coming evil, and a manhood drenched and blighted by the pitiless descent of the storm, could painfully impress the mind, his probably was impressed in no golden characters. If, however, he had a great end of restoration in view, it was not in his power to employ great means for its attainment. He was obliged to be content with the day of small things. When he came to Yorkshire, he whose ancestors had owned warehouses in this seaport, and factories in that inland town, had possessed their townhouse and their country seat saw no way open to him but to rent a cloth mill in an out-of-the-way nook of an out-of-the-way district, to take a cottage adjoining it for his residence, and to add to his possessions, as pasture for his horse, and space for his cloth tenters, a few acres of the steep, rugged land that lined the hollow through which his mill stream brawled. All this he held at a somewhat high rent, for these war times were hard, and everything was dear, of the trustees of the Fieldhead estate, than the property of a miner. At the time this history commences, Robert Moore had lived but 2 years in the district, during which period he had at least proved himself possessed of the quality of activity. The dingy cottage was converted into a neat, tasteful residence. Of part of the rough land he had made garden ground, which he cultivated with singular, even with Flemish, exactness and care. As to the mill, which was an old structure, and fitted up with old machinery, now become inefficient and out of date, he had from the first evinced the strongest contempt for all its arrangements and appointments. His aim had been to effect a radical reform, which he had executed as fast as his very limited capital would allow, and the narrowness of that capital, and consequent check on his progress, was a restraint which galled his spirit sorely. Moore ever wanted to push on. Forward was the device stamped upon his soul, but poverty curbed him. Sometimes, figuratively, he foamed at the mouth when the reins were drawn very tight. In this state of feeling, it is not to be expected that he would deliberate much as to whether his advance was or was not prejudicial to others. Not being a native, nor for any length of time a resident of the neighborhood, he did not sufficiently care when the new inventions threw the old workpeople out of employ. He never asked himself where those to whom he no longer paid weekly wages found daily bread, and in this negligence he only resembled thousands besides, on whom the starving poor of Yorkshire seemed to have a closer claim. The period of which I write was an overshadowed one in British history, and especially in the history of the northern provinces. War was then at its height. Europe was all involved therein. England, if not weary, was worn with long resistance, yes, and half her people were weary too, and cried out for peace on any terms. National honor was become a mere empty name, of no value in the eyes of many, because their sight was dim with famine, and for a morsel of meat they would have sold their birthright. The orders in council, provoked by Napoleon's Milan and Berlin decrees, and forbidding neutral powers to trade with France, had, by offending America, cut off the principal market of the Yorkshire woolen trade, and brought it consequently to the verge of ruin. Minor foreign markets were glutted, and would receive no more. The Brazils, Portugal, Sicily, were all overstocked by nearly 2 years' consumption. At this crisis certain inventions and machinery were introduced into the staple manufactures of the North, which, greatly reducing the number of hands necessary to be employed, threw thousands out of work, and left them without legitimate means of sustaining life. A bad harvest supervened. Distress reached its climax. Endurance, overgoaded, stretched the hand of fraternity to sedition. The throes of a sort of moral earthquake were felt heaving under the hills of the northern counties. But, as is usual in such cases, nobody took much notice. When a food riot broke out in a manufacturing town, when a gig mill was burnt to the ground, or a manufacturer's house was attacked, the furniture thrown into the streets, and the family forced to flee for their lives, some local measures were or were not taken by the local magistracy. A ringleader was detected, or more frequently suffered to elude detection, newspaper paragraphs were written on the subject, and there the thing stopped. As to the sufferers, whose sole inheritance was labor, and who had lost that inheritance who could not get work, and consequently could not get wages, and consequently could not get bread, they were left to suffer on, perhaps inevitably left. It would not do to stop the progress of invention, to damage science by discouraging its improvements. The war could not be terminated, efficient relief could not be raised. There was no help then, so the unemployed underwent their destiny, ate the bread and drank the waters of affliction. Misery generates hate. These sufferers hated the machines which they believed took their bread from them, they hated the buildings which contained those machines, they hated the manufacturers who owned those buildings. In the parish of Briarfield, with which we have at present to do, Hollows Mill was the place held most abominable. Gerard Moore, in his double character of semi-foreigner and thoroughgoing progressist, the man most abominated. And it perhaps rather agreed with Moore's temperament than otherwise to be generally hated, especially when he believed the thing for which he was hated a right and an expedient thing, and it was with a sense of warlike excitement he, on this night, sat in his counting-house waiting the arrival of his frame-laden wagons. Malone's coming and company were, it may be, most unwelcome to him. He would have preferred sitting alone, for he liked a silent, somber, unsafe solitude. His watchman's musket would have been company enough for him, the full-flowing beck in the den would have delivered continuously the discourse most genial to his ear. With the queerest look in the world had the manufacturer for some 10 minutes been watching the Irish curate, as the latter made free with the punch, when suddenly that steady grey eye changed, as if another vision came between it and Malone. Moore raised his hand. "Chut!" he said in his French fashion, as Malone made a noise with his glass. He listened a moment, then rose, put his hat on, and went out at the counting-house door. The night was still, dark, and stagnant, the water yet rushed on full and fast, its flow almost seemed a flood in the utter silence. Moore's ear, however, caught another sound, very distant but yet dissimilar, broken and rugged and short, a sound of heavy wheels crunching a stony road. He returned to the counting-house and lit a lantern, with which he walked down the mill yard, and proceeded to open the gates. The big wagons were coming on, the dray horses' huge hoofs were heard splashing in the mud and water. Moore hailed them. "Hey, Joe Scott. Is all right?" Probably Joe Scott was yet at too great a distance to hear the inquiry. He did not answer it. "Is all right, I say?" again asked Moore, when the elephant-like leader's nose almost touched his. Someone jumped out from the foremost wagon into the road. A voice cried aloud, Ay, divil, all's right. We've smashed him." And there was a run. The wagons stood still, they were now deserted. "Joe Scott." "No," Joe Scott answered. "Murgatroyd. Pig Hills. Sykes." No reply. Mr. Moore lifted his lantern and looked into the vehicles. There was neither man nor machinery, they were empty and abandoned. Now Mr. Moore loved his machinery. He had risked the last of his capital on the purchase of these frames and shears which tonight had been expected. Speculations most important to his interests depended on the results to be wrought by them. Where were they? The words "we've smashed them" rang in his ears. How did the catastrophe affect him? By the light of the lantern he held were his features visible, relaxing to a singular smile, the smile the man of determined spirit wears when he reaches a juncture in his life where this determined spirit is to feel a demand on its strength, when the strain is to be made, and the faculty must bear or break. Yet he remained silent, and even motionless, for at the instant he neither knew what to say nor what to do. He placed the lantern on the ground, and stood with his arms folded, gazing down and reflecting. An impatient trampling of one of the horses made him presently look up. His eye in the moment caught the gleam of something white attached to a part of the harness. Examined by the light of the lantern, this proved to be a folded paper A billet. It bore no address without, within was the superscription, "- to the divil of Hollows Mill." We will not copy the rest of the orthography, which was very peculiar, but translated into legible English. It ran thus, -- "Your hellish machinery is shivered to smash on Stillborough Moor, and your men are lying bound hand and foot in a ditch by the roadside. Take this as a warning from men that are starving, and have starving wives and children to go home to when they have done this deed. If you get new machines, or if you otherwise go on as you have done, you shall hear from us again. Beware." "Hear from you again?" "Yes, I'll hear from you again, and you shall hear from me. I'll speak to you directly. On Stillborough Moor you shall hear from me in a moment." Having led the wagons within the gates, He hastened towards the cottage. Opening the door, he spoke a few words quickly but quietly to two females who ran to meet him in the passage. He calmed the seeming alarm of one by a brief palliative account of what had taken place. To the other he said, "Go into the mill, Sarah, there is the key, and ring the mill bell as loud as you can. Afterwards you will get another lantern and help me to light up the front." Returning to his horses, he unharnessed, fed, and stabled them with equal speed and care, pausing occasionally, while so occupied, as if to listen for the mill bell. It clanged out presently, with irregular but loud and alarming din. The hurried, agitated peal seemed more urgent than if the summons had been steadily given by a practiced hand. On that still night, at that unusual hour, it was heard a long way round. The guests in the kitchen of the Red House were startled by the clamor, and declaring that there must be somewhat more nor common to do at Hollow's Milne, they called for lanterns, and hurried to the spot in a body. And scarcely had they thronged into the yard with their gleaming lights, when the tramp of horses was heard, and a little man in a shovel hat, sitting erect on the back of a shaggy pony, rode lightly in, followed by an aide-de-camp mounted on a larger steed. Mr. Moore, meantime, after stabling his dray horses, had saddled his hackney, and with the aid of Sarah, the servant, lit up his mill, whose wide and long front now glared one great illumination, throwing a sufficient light on the yard to obviate all fear of confusion arising from obscurity. Already a deep hum of voices became audible. Mr. Malone had at length issued from the counting house, previously taking the precaution to dip his head and face in the stone water jug, and this precaution, together with the sudden alarm, had nearly restored to him the possession of those senses which the punch had partially scattered. He stood with his hat on the back of his head, and his shillelagh grasped in his dexter fist, answering much at random the questions of the newly arrived party from the Red House. Mr. Moore now appeared, and was immediately confronted by the shovel hat and the shaggy pony. "Well, Moore, what is your business with us? I thought you would want us to knight me and the headman here," patting his pony's neck, "and Tom and his charger. When I heard your mill bell I could sit still no longer, so I left Boltby to finish his supper alone. But where is the enemy? I do not see a mask or a smutted face present, and there is not a pane of glass broken in your windows. Have you had an attack, or do you expect one?"
"Oh, not at all. I have neither had one nor expect one," answered Moore coolly. "I only ordered the bell to be rung because I want two or three neighbors to stay here in the hollow while I and a couple or so more go over to Stillbrow Moor."
"To Stillbrow Moor? What to do? To meet the wagons?"
"The wagons are come home an hour ago."
"Then all's right. What more would you have?"
"They came home empty, and Joe Scott and company are left on the moor, and so are the frames. Read that scrawl."
Mr. Helstone received and perused the document of which the contents had before been given.
"Hum. They've only served you as they serve others. But, however, the poor fellows in the ditch will be expecting help with some impatience. This is a wet night for such a berth. I and Tom will go with you. Malone may stay behind and take care of the mill. What is the matter with him? His eyes seem starting out of his head.
He has been eating a mutton chop."
"Indeed. Peter Augustus, be on your guard. Eat no more mutton chops tonight. You are left here in command of these premises, an honorable post.
Is anybody to stay with me?"
"As many of the present assemblage as choose. My lads, how many of you will remain here, and how many will go a little way with me and Mr. Moore on the Stillbrow Road, to meet some men who have been waylaid and assaulted by framebreakers?"
The small number of three volunteered to go, the rest preferred staying behind. As Mr. Moore mounted his horse, the rector asked him in a low voice whether he had locked up the mutton chops, so that Peter Augustus could not get at them? The manufacturer nodded an affirmative, and the rescue party set out.
Chapter 3.
Mr. York. Cheerfulness, it would appear, is a matter which depends fully as much on the state of things within as on the state of things without and around us. I make this trite remark, because I happen to know that Messrs. Helstone and Moore trotted forth from the mill yard gates, at the head of their very small company, in the best possible spirits. When a ray from a lantern, the three pedestrians of the party carried each one, fell on Mr. Moore's face, you could see an unusual, because a lively, spark dancing in his eyes, and a newfound vivacity mantling on his dark physiognomy, and when the rector's visage was illuminated, his hard features were revealed all aggrin and ashine with glee. Yet a drizzling night, a somewhat perilous expedition, you would think were not circumstances calculated to enliven those exposed to the wet and engaged in the adventure. If any member or members of the crew who had been at work on Stillbrow Moor had caught a view of this party, they would have had great pleasure in shooting either of the leaders from behind a wall, and the leaders knew this, and the fact is, being both men of steely nerves and steady beating hearts, were elate with the knowledge. I am aware, reader, and you need not remind me, that it is a dreadful thing for a parson to be warlike. I am aware that he should be a man of peace. I have some faint outline of an idea of what a clergyman's mission is amongst mankind, and I remember distinctly whose servant he is, whose message he delivers, whose example he should follow. Yet, with all this, if you are a parson hater, you need not expect me to go along with you every step of your dismal, downward tending, unchristian road. You need not expect me to join in your deep anathemas, at once so narrow and so sweeping, in your poisonous rancor, so intense and so absurd, against the cloth, to lift up my eyes and hands with a supplejo, or to inflate my lungs with a barraclough, in horror and denunciation of the diabolical rector of Briarfield. He was not diabolical at all. The evil simply was he had missed his vocation. He should have been a soldier, and circumstances had made him a priest. For the rest, he was a conscientious, hard-headed, hard-handed, brave, stern, implacable, faithful little man, a man almost without sympathy, ungentle, prejudiced, and rigid, but a man true to principle, honorable, sagacious, and sincere. It seems to me, reader, that you cannot always cut out men to fit their profession, and that you ought not to curse them because their profession sometimes hangs on them ungracefully. Nor will I curse Halstone, clerical Cossack as he was. Yet he was cursed, and by many of his own parishioners, as by others he was adored, which is the frequent fate of men who show partiality in friendship and bitterness in enmity, who are equally attached to principles and adherent to prejudices. Halstone and Moore being both in excellent spirits, and united for the present in one cause, you would expect that, as they rode side by side, they would converse amicably. Oh no! These two men, of hard, bilious natures both, rarely came into contact, but they chafed each other's moods. Their frequent bone of contention was the war. Halstone was a high Tory, there were Tories in those days, and Moore was a bitter Whig, a Whig, at least, as far as opposition to the war party was concerned, that being the question which affected his own interest, and only on that question did he profess any British politics at all. He liked to infuriate Halstone by declaring his belief in the invincibility of Bonaparte, by taunting England and Europe with the impotence of their efforts to withstand him, and by coolly advancing the opinion that it was as well to yield to him soon as late, since he must in the end crush every antagonist, and reign supreme. Halstone could not bear these sentiments. It was only on the consideration of Moore being a sort of outcast and alien, and having but half measure of British blood to temper the foreign gall which corroded his veins, that he brought himself to listen to them without indulging the wish he felt to cane the speaker. Another thing, too, somewhat allayed his disgust, namely, a fellow feeling for the dogged tone with which these opinions were asserted, and a respect for the consistency of Moore's crabbed contumacy. As the party turned into the Stillborough Road, they met what little wind there was, the rain dashed in their faces. Moore had been fretting his companion previously, and now, braced up by the raw breeze, and perhaps irritated by the sharp drizzle, he began to goad him. "Does your peninsular news please you still?" he asked. "What do you mean?" was the surly demand of the rector. "I mean, have you still faith in that bale of a Lord Wellington? And what do you mean now? Do you still believe that this wooden-faced and pebble-hearted idol of England has power to send fire down from heaven to consume the French holocaust you want to offer up? I believe Wellington will flog Bonaparte's marshals into the sea the day it pleases him to lift his arm. But, my dear sir, you can't be serious in what you say. Bonaparte's marshals are great men, who act under the guidance of an omnipotent master spirit. Your Wellington is the most humdrum of commonplace martinets, whose slow, mechanical movements are further cramped by an ignorant home government. Wellington is the soul of England. Wellington is the right champion of a good cause, the fit representative of a powerful, a resolute, a sensible, and an honest nation. Your good cause, as far as I understand it, is simply the restoration of that filthy, feeble Ferdinand to a throne which he disgraced. Your fit representative of an honest people is the dull-witted drover, acting for a duller-witted farmer, and against these are arrayed victorious supremacy and invincible genius. Against legitimacy is arrayed usurpation, against modest, single-minded, righteous, and brave resistance to encroachment is arrayed boastful, devil-tongued, selfish, and treacherous ambition to possess. God defend the right. God often defends the powerful. What? I suppose the handful of Israelites standing dryshod on the Asiatic side of the Red Sea was more powerful than the host of the Egyptians drawn up on the African side? Were they more numerous? Were they better appointed? Were they more mighty, in a word, eh? Don't speak, or you'll tell a lie, more, you know you will. They were a poor, overwrought band of bondsmen. Tyrants had oppressed them through 400 years, a feeble mixture of women and children diluted their thin ranks, their masters, who roared to follow them through the divided flood, were a set of pampered Ethiops, about as strong and brutal as the lions of Libya. They were armed, horsed, and charioted, the poor Hebrew wanderers were afoot. Few of them, it is likely, had better weapons than their shepherd's crooks or their mason's building tools, their meek and mighty leader himself had only his rod. But bethink you, Robert Moore, right was with them, the God of battles was on their side. Crime and the lost archangel generaled the ranks of Pharaoh, and which triumphed. We know that well. The Lord saved Israel that day out of the hand of the Egyptians, and Israel saw the Egyptians dead upon the seashore, yea, the depths covered them, they sank to the bottom as a stone. The right hand of the Lord became glorious in power, the right hand of the Lord dashed in pieces the enemy. You are all right, only you forget the true parallel. France is Israel, and Napoleon is Moses. Europe, with her old overgorged empires and rotten dynasties, is corrupt Egypt, gallant France is the 12 tribes, and her fresh and vigorous usurper the shepherd of Horeb. I scorn to answer you. Moore accordingly answered himself at least, he subjoined to what he had just said an additional observation in a lower voice. Oh, in Italy he was as great as any Moses. He was the right thing there, fit to head and organize measures for the regeneration of nations. It puzzles me to this day how the conqueror of Lodi should have condescended to become an emperor, a vulgar, a stupid humbug, and still more how a people who had once called themselves republicans should have sunk again to the grade of mere slaves. I despise France. If England had gone as far on the march of civilization as France did, she would hardly have retreated so shamelessly. You don't mean to say that besotted imperial France is any worse than bloody republican France? Demanded Halstone fiercely. I mean to say nothing, but I can think what I please, you know, Mr. Halstone, both about France and England, and about revolutions, and regicides, and restorations in general, and about the divine right of kings, which you often stickle for in your sermons, and the duty of non-resistance, and the sanity of war, and... Mr. Moore's sentence was here cut short by the rapid rolling up of a gig, and its sudden stoppage in the middle of the road. Both he and the rector had been too much occupied with their discourse to notice its approach till it was close upon them. Nah, maester, did TH wagons hit home? Demanded a voice from the vehicle. Can that be Joe Scott? Eh. Returned another voice, for the gig contained 2 persons, as was seen by the glimmer of its lamp. The men with the lanterns had now fallen into the rear, or rather, the equestrians of the rescue party had outridden the pedestrians. Eh, Mr. Moore. It's Joe Scott. I'm bringing him back to you in a bonny pickle. I found him on the top of the moor yonder, him and 3 others. What will you give me for restoring him to you? Why, my thanks, I believe, for I could better have afforded to lose a better man. That is you, I suppose, Mr. York, by your voice? Eh, lad, it's me. I was coming home from Stillborough Market, and just as I got to the middle of the moor, and was whipping on as swift as the wind, for these, they say, are not safe times, thanks to a bad government, I heard a groan. I pulled up. Some would have whipped on faster, but I've naught to fear that I know of. I don't believe there's a lad in these parts would harm me at least, I'd give them as good as I got if they offered to do it. I said, is there aught wrong anywhere? Deed is there, somebody says, speaking out of the ground, like. What's to do? Be sharp and tell me, I ordered. No but 4 on us leaguing in a ditch, says Joe, as quiet as could be. I tell them more shame to them, and bid them get up and move on, or I'd lend them a lick of the gig whip, for my notion was they were all fresh. We'd ha done that an hour sin, but we're teed why a bit a band, says Joe. So in a while I got down and loosed them why my penknife, and Scott would ride why me, to tell me all how it happened, and t' others are coming on as fast as their feet will bring them. Well, I am greatly obliged to you, Mr. York. Are you, my lad? You know you're not. However, here are the rest approaching. And here, by the Lord, is another set with lights in their pitchers, like the army of Gideon, and as we've TH Parson Y, us good evening, Mr. Halstone West do. Mr. Halstone returned the salutation of the individual in the gig very stiffly indeed.
That individual proceeded, dash. We're 11 strong men, and there's both horses and chariots among us. If we could only fall on why some of these starved ragamuffins of framebreakers, we could win a grand victory. We could for rye one be a Wellington that would please ye, Mr. Helstone and Zish paragraph says we could contrive for tea papers. Briarfield sold be famous. But Wes have a column and a half ith still bro courier over this job, as it is, I dare say. I's expect no less. And I'll promise you no less, Mr. York, for I'll write the article myself, returned the rector. To be sure certainly. And mind ye recommend weel that the mat break tea bits of frames, and tea Joe Scott's legs why band, sell be hung without benefit of clergy. It's a hanging matter, or sell be. No doubt of that. If I judge them I give them short shrift, cried Moore. But I mean to let them quite alone this bout, to give them rope enough, certain that in the end they will hang themselves. Let them alone, will ye, Moore? Do you promise that?
Promise? No. All I mean to say is, I shall give myself no particular trouble to catch them, but if one falls in my way,
you'll snap him up, of course. Only you would rather they would do something worse than merely stop a wagon before you reckon with them. Well, we'll say no more on the subject at present. Here we are at my door, gentlemen, and I hope you and the men will step in. You will none of you be the worse of a little refreshment. Moore and Helstone opposed this proposition as unnecessary. It was, however, pressed on them so courteously, and the night, besides, was so inclement, and the gleam from the muslin curtain windows of the house before which they had halted looked so inviting, that at length they yielded. Mr. York, after having alighted from his gig, which he left in charge of a man who issued from an outbuilding on his arrival, led the way in. It will have been remarked that Mr. York varied a little in his phraseology. Now he spoke broad Yorkshire, and anon he expressed himself in very pure English. His manner seemed liable to equal alternations. He could be polite and affable, and he could be blunt and rough. His station then you could not easily determine by his speech and demeanor. Perhaps the appearance of his residence may decide it. The men he recommended to take the kitchen way, saying that he would see them served why some at the taste presently. The gentlemen were ushered in at the front entrance. They found themselves in a matted hall, lined almost to the ceiling with pictures. Through this they were conducted to a large parlor, with a magnificent fire in the grate, the most cheerful of rooms it appeared as a whole, and when you came to examine details, the enlivening effect was not diminished. There was no splendor, but there was taste everywhere, unusual taste, the taste, you would have said, of a traveled man, a scholar, and a gentleman. A series of Italian views decked the walls. Each of these was a specimen of true art. A connoisseur had selected them, they were genuine and valuable. Even by candlelight the bright clear skies, the soft distances, with blue air quivering between the eye and the hills, the fresh tints, and well-masked lights and shadows, charmed the view. The subjects were all pastoral, the scenes were all sunny. There was a guitar and some music on a sofa, there were cameos, beautiful miniatures, a set of Grecian-looking vases on the mantelpiece, there were books well arranged in two elegant bookcases. Mr. York bade his guests be seated. He then rang for wine. To the servant who brought it he gave hospitable orders for the refreshment of the men in the kitchen. The rector remained standing, he seemed not to like his quarters, he would not touch the wine his host offered him. "E'en as you will," remarked Mr. York. "I reckon you're thinking of Eastern customs, Mr. Helstone, and you'll not eat nor drink under my roof, feared we sold be forced to be friends, but I am not so particular or superstitious. You might sup the contents of that decanter, and you might give me a bottle of the best in your own cellar, and I'd hold myself free to oppose you at every turn still in every vestry meeting and justice meeting where we encountered one another. It is just what I should expect of you, Mr. York. Does it agree why ye now, Mr. Helstone, to be riding out after rioters, of the wet night, at your age? It always agrees with me to be doing my duty, and in this case my duty is a thorough pleasure. To hunt down vermin is a noble occupation, fit for an archbishop. Fit for ye, at any rate. But where's T. Curate? He's happen gone to visit some poor body in a sick gird, or he's happen hunting down vermin in another direction. He is doing garrison duty at Hollow's Mill. You left him a sup of wine, I hope, Bob, turning to Mr. Moore, to keep his courage up? He did not pause for an answer, but continued, quickly, still addressing Moore, who had thrown himself into an old-fashioned chair by the fireside. "Move it, Robert. Get up, my lad. That place is mine. Take the sofa, or three other chairs, if you will, but not this.
It belongs to me, and nobody else.
Why are you so particular to that chair, Mr. York? Asked Moore, lazily vacating the place in obedience to orders.
My father wore it for me, and that's all the answer I shall give thee, and it's as good a reason as Mr. Helstone can give for the main feck of his notions.
Moore, are you ready to go? Inquired the rector.
Nay, Robert's not ready, or rather, I'm not ready to part with him. He's an ill lad, and wants correcting.
Why, sir? What have I done?
Made thyself enemies on every hand.
What do I care for that? What difference does it make to me whether your Yorkshire lads hate me or like me?
Eh, there it is. The lad is a mock of an alien among us. His father would never have talked I that way. Go back to Antwerp, where you were born and bred, mauvais tate.
Mauvais tape umem, j'ai ni fait que mon devoir, quant à vos lourdaudes de paysan, j'ai mon moque.
En revanche, mon garçon, nos lourdaudes de paysan se moqueront de toi, sois en certain, replied York, speaking with nearly as pure a French accent as Gérard Moore.
C'est bon, et puisque cela m'est égal, que mes amis ne s'en inquiètent pas.
Tes amis, où sont ils, tes amis?
J'ai fait écho, où sont ils? Et je suis fort as que le cosuwire upon. Au diable les amis. J'ai mis au vieux encore du moment où mon père et mes oncles Gérard Appelrent autour du leur amis, et tu sais si les amis se sont empresses de courir à leur secours.
Tenez, M. York, c'est moi, M.E., mirait trop, ni mon parler plus.
Comme tu voudras. And here Mr. York held his peace, and while he sits leaning back in his three-cornered carved oak chair, I will snatch my opportunity to sketch the portrait of this French-speaking Yorkshire gentleman.
Chapter 4.
Mr. York, continued. A Yorkshire gentleman he was, par excellence, in every point, about 55 years old, but looking at first sight still older, for his hair was silver-white. His forehead was broad, not high, his face fresh and hale. The harshness of the North was seen in his features, as it was heard in his voice. Every trait was thoroughly English, not a Norman line anywhere. It was an inelegant, unclassic, unaristocratic mold of visage. Fine people would perhaps have called it vulgar, sensible people would have termed it characteristic, shrewd people would have delighted in it for the pith, sagacity, intelligence, the root yet real originality marked in every lineament, latent in every furrow. But it was an indocile, a scornful, and a sarcastic face, the face of a man difficult to lead, and impossible to drive. His stature was rather tall, and he was well made and wiry, and had a stately integrity of port. There was not a suspicion of the clown about him anywhere. I did not find it easy to sketch Mr. York's person, but it is more difficult to indicate his mind. If you expect to be treated to a perfection, reader, or even to a benevolent, philanthropic old gentleman in him, you are mistaken. He has spoken with some sense and with some good feeling to Mr. Moore, but you are not thence to conclude that he always spoke and thought justly and kindly. Mr. York, in the first place, was without the organ of veneration a great want, and which throws a man wrong on every point where veneration is required. Secondly, he was without the organ of comparison a deficiency which strips a man of sympathy, and thirdly, he had too little of the organs of benevolence and ideality, which took the glory and softness from his nature, and for him diminished those divine qualities throughout the universe. The want of veneration made him intolerant to those above him, kings and nobles and priests, dynasties and parliaments and establishments, with all their doings, most of their enactments, their forms, their rights, their claims, were to him an abomination, all rubbish. He found no use or pleasure in them, and believed it would be clear gain, and no damage to the world, if its high places were raised, and their occupants crushed in the fall. The want of veneration, too, made him dead at heart to the electric delight of admiring what is admirable. It dried up a thousand pure sources of enjoyment, it withered a thousand vivid pleasures. He was not irreligious, though a member of no sect, but his religion could not be that of one who knows how to venerate. He believed in God and heaven, but his God and heaven were those of a man in whom awe, imagination, and tenderness lack. The weakness of his powers of comparison made him inconsistent. While he professed some excellent general doctrines of mutual toleration and forbearance, he cherished towards certain classes a bigoted antipathy. He spoke of parsons and all who belonged to parsons, of lords and the appendages of lords, with a harshness, sometimes an insolence, as unjust as it was insufferable. He could not place himself in the position of those he vituperated,
He could not compare their errors with their temptations, their defects with their disadvantages. He could not realize the effect of such and such circumstances on himself similarly situated, and he would often express the most ferocious and tyrannical wishes regarding those who had acted, as he thought, ferociously and tyrannically. To judge by his threats, he would have employed arbitrary, even cruel, means to advance the cause of freedom and equality. Equality. Yes, Mr. York talked about equality, but at heart he was a proud man, very friendly to his workpeople, very good to all who were beneath him, and submitted quietly to be beneath him, but haughty as Beelzebub to whomsoever the world deemed, for he deemed no man, his superior. Revolt was in his blood, he could not bear control, his father, his grandfather before him, could not bear it, and his children after him never could. The want of general benevolence made him very impatient of imbecility, and of all faults which grated on his strong, shrewd nature, it left no check to his cutting sarcasm. As he was not merciful, he would sometimes wound and wound again, without noticing how much he hurt, or caring how deep he thrust. As to the paucity of ideality in his mind, that can scarcely be called a fault. A fine ear for music, a correct eye for color and form, left him the quality of taste, and who cares for imagination? Who does not think it a rather dangerous, senseless attribute, akin to weakness, perhaps partaking of frenzy, a disease rather than a gift of the mind? Probably all think it so, but those who possess, or fancy they possess, it. To hear them speak, you would believe that their hearts would be cold if that elixir did not flow about them, that their eyes would be dim if that flame did not refine their vision, that they would be lonely if this strange companion abandoned them. You would suppose that it imparted some glad hope to spring, some fine charm to summer, some tranquil joy to autumn, some consolation to winter, which you do not feel. An illusion, of course, but the fanatics cling to their dream, and would not give it for gold. As Mr. York did not possess poetic imagination himself, he considered it a most superfluous quality in others. Painters and musicians he could tolerate, and even encourage, because he could relish the results of their art. He could see the charm of a fine picture, and feel the pleasure of good music, but a quiet poet, whatever force struggled, whatever fire glowed in his breast, if he could not have played the man in the counting house, of the tradesman in the peace hall, might have lived despised, and died scorned, under the eyes of Hiram York. And as there are many Hiram Yorks in the world, it is well that the true poet, quiet externally though he may be, has often a truculent spirit under his placidity, and is full of shrewdness in his meekness, and can measure the whole stature of those who look down on him, and correctly ascertain the weight and value of the pursuits they disdain him for not having followed. It is happy that he can have his own bliss, his own society with his great friend and goddess Nature, quite independent of those who find little pleasure in him, and in whom he finds no pleasure at all. It is just that while the world and circumstances often turn a dark, cold side to him, and properly, too, because he first turns a dark, cold, careless side to them, he should be able to maintain a festal brightness and cherishing glow in his bosom, which makes all bright and genial for him, while strangers, perhaps, deem his existence a polar winter never gladdened by a sun. The true poet is not one whit to be pitied, and he is apt to laugh in his sleeve when any misguided sympathizer whines over his wrongs. Even when utilitarians sit in judgment on him, and pronounce him and his art useless, he hears the sentence with such a hard derision, such a broad, deep, comprehensive, and merciless contempt of the unhappy Pharisees who pronounce it, that he is rather to be chidden than condoled with. These, however, are not Mr. York's reflections, and it is with Mr. York we have at present to do. I have told you some of his faults, reader. As to his good points, he was one of the most honorable and capable men in Yorkshire. Even those who disliked him were forced to respect him. He was much beloved by the poor, because he was thoroughly kind and very fatherly to them. To his workmen he was considerate and cordial. When he dismissed them from an occupation, he would try to set them on to something else, or, if that was impossible, help them to remove with their families to a district where work might possibly be had. It must also be remarked that if, as sometimes chanced, any individual amongst his hands showed signs of insubordination, York, who, like many who abhor being controlled, knew how to control with vigor, had the secret of crushing rebellion in the germ, of eradicating it like a bad weed, so that it never spread or developed within the sphere of his authority. Such being the happy state of his own affairs, he felt himself at liberty to speak with the utmost severity of those who were differently situated, to ascribe whatever was unpleasant in their position entirely to their own fault, to sever himself from the masters, and advocate freely the cause of the operatives. Mr. York's family was the first and oldest in the district, and he,
though not the wealthiest, was one of the most influential men. His education had been good. In his youth, before the French Revolution, he had traveled on the continent. He was an adept in the French and Italian languages. During a 2 years sojourn in Italy, he had collected many good paintings and tasteful rarities, with which his residence was now adorned. His manners, when he liked, were those of a Finnish gentleman of the old school. His conversation, when he was disposed to please, was singularly interesting and original, and if he usually expressed himself in the Yorkshire dialect, it was because he chose to do so, preferring his native Doric to a more refined vocabulary. A Yorkshire burr, he affirmed, was as much better than a Cockney's lisp as a bull's bellow than a Raton's squeak. Mr. York knew everyone, and was known by everyone, for miles round, yet his intimate acquaintances were very few. Himself thoroughly original, he had no taste for what was ordinary, a racy, rough character, high or low, ever found acceptance with him. A refined, insipid personage, however exalted in station, was his aversion. He would spend an hour any time in talking freely with a shrewd workman of his own, or with some queer, sagacious old woman amongst his cottagers, when he would have grudged a moment to a commonplace fine gentleman or to the most fashionable and elegant, if frivolous, lady. His preferences on these points he carried to an extreme, forgetting that there may be amiable and even admirable characters amongst those who cannot be original. Yet he made exceptions to his own rule. There was a certain order of mind, plain, ingenuous, neglecting refinement, almost devoid of intellectuality, and quite incapable of appreciating what was intellectual in him, but which, at the same time, never felt disgust at his rudeness, was not easily wounded by his sarcasm, did not closely analyze his sayings, doings, or opinions, with which he was peculiarly at ease, and, consequently, which he peculiarly preferred. He was lord amongst such characters. They, while submitting implicitly to his influence, never acknowledged, because they never reflected on, his superiority. They were quite tractable, therefore, without running the smallest danger of being servile, and their unthinking, easy, artless insensibility was as acceptable, because as convenient, to Mr. York as that of the chair he sat on, or of the floor he trod. It will have been observed that he was not quite uncordial with Mr. Moore. He had two or three reasons for entertaining a faint partiality to that gentleman. It may sound odd, but the first of these was that Moore spoke English with a foreign, and French with a perfectly pure, accent, and that his dark, thin face, with its fine though rather wasted lines, had a most anti-British and anti-Yorkshire look. These points seem frivolous, unlikely to influence a character like York's, but the fact is they recalled old, perhaps pleasurable, associations. They brought back his traveling, his youthful days. He had seen, amidst Italian cities and scenes, faces like Moore's. He had heard, in Parisian cafes and theaters, voices like his. He was young then, and when he looked at and listened to the alien, he seemed young again. Secondly, he had known Moore's father, and had had dealings with him. That was a more substantial, though by no means a more agreeable tie, for as his firm had been connected with Moore's in business, it had also, in some measure, been implicated in its losses. Thirdly, he had found Robert himself a sharp man of business. He saw reason to anticipate that he would, in the end, by one means or another, make money, and he respected both his resolution and acuteness, perhaps, also, his hardness. A fourth circumstance which drew them together was that of Mr. York being one of the guardians of the miner on whose estate Hollow's Mill was situated. Consequently Moore, in the course of his alterations and improvements, had frequent occasion to consult him. As to the other guest now present in Mr. York's parlor, Mr. Helstone, between him and his host there existed a double antipathy, the antipathy of nature and that of circumstances. The freethinker hated the formalist, the lover of liberty detested the disciplinarian. Besides, it was said that in former years they had been rival suitors of the same lady. Mr. York, as a general rule, was, when young, noted for his preference of sprightly and dashing women, a showy shape and air, a lively wit, a ready tongue, chiefly seemed to attract him. He never, however, proposed to any of these brilliant belles whose society he sought, and all at once he seriously fell in love with and eagerly wooed a girl who presented a complete contrast to those he had hitherto noticed, a girl with the face of a Madonna, a girl of living marble stillness personified. No matter that,
When he spoke to her, she only answered him in monosyllables, no matter that his sighs seemed unheard, that his glances were unreturned, that she never responded to his opinions, rarely smiled at his jests, paid him no respect and no attention, no matter that she seemed the opposite of everything feminine he had ever in his whole life been known to admire. For him, Mary Kate was perfect, because somehow, for some reason, no doubt he had a reason he loved her. Mr. Helstone, at that time curate of Briarfield, loved Mary too, or, at any rate, he fancied her. Several others admired her, for she was beautiful as a monumental angel, but the clergyman was preferred for his office's sake, that office probably investing him with some of the illusion necessary to allure to the commission of matrimony, and which Miss Kate did not find in any of the young wool staplers, her other adorers. Mr. Helstone neither had, nor professed to have, Mr. York's absorbing passion for her. He had none of the humble reverence which seemed to subdue most of her suitors. He saw her more as she really was than the rest did. He was, consequently, more master of her and himself. She accepted him at the first offer, and they were married. Nature never intended Mr. Helstone to make a very good husband, especially to a quiet wife. He thought so long as a woman was silent, nothing ailed her, and she wanted nothing. If she did not complain of solitude, solitude, however continued, could not be irksome to her. If she did not talk and put herself forward, express a partiality for this, an aversion to that, she had no partialities or aversions, and it was useless to consult her tastes. He made no pretense of comprehending women, or comparing them with men. They were a different, probably a very inferior, order of existence. A wife could not be her husband's companion, much less his confidant, much less his stay. His wife, after a year or two, was of no great importance to him in any shape, and when she one day, as he thought, suddenly, for he had scarcely noticed her decline, but, as others thought, gradually, took her leave of him and of life, and there was only a still, beautiful featured mold of clay left, cold and white, in the conjugal couch, he felt his bereavement who shall say how little. Yet, perhaps, more than he seemed to feel it, for he was not a man from whom grief easily wrung tears. His dry-eyed and sober mourning scandalized an old housekeeper, and likewise a female attendant, who had waited upon Mrs. Helstone in her sickness, and who, perhaps, had had opportunities of learning more of the deceased lady's nature, of her capacity for feeling and loving, than her husband knew. They gossiped together over the corpse, related anecdotes, with embellishments of her lingering decline, and its real or supposed cause. In short, they worked each other up to some indignation against the austere little man, who sat examining papers in an adjoining room, unconscious of what opprobrium he was the object. Mrs. Helstone was hardly under the sod when rumors began to be rife in the neighborhood that she had died of a broken heart. These magnified quickly into reports of hard usage, and, finally, details of harsh treatment on the part of her husband, reports grossly untrue, but not the less eagerly received on that account. Mr. York heard them, partly believed them. Already, of course, he had no friendly feeling to his successful rival. Though himself a married man now, and united to a woman who seemed a complete contrast to Mary Kate in all respects, he could not forget the great disappointment of his life, and when he heard that what would have been so precious to him had been neglected, perhaps abused, by another, he conceived for that other a rooted and bitter animosity. Of the nature and strength of this animosity Mr. Helstone was but half aware. He neither knew how much York had loved Mary Kate, what he had felt on losing her, nor was he conscious of the calumnies concerning his treatment of her, familiar to every ear in the neighborhood but his own. He believed political and religious differences alone separated him and Mr. York. Had he known how the case really stood, he would hardly have been induced by any persuasion to cross his former rival's threshold. Mr. York did not resume his lecture of Robert Moore. The conversation ere long recommenced in a more general form, though still in a somewhat disputative tone. The unquiet state of the country, the various depredations lately committed on mill property in the district, supplied abundant matter for disagreement, especially as each of the three gentlemen present differed more or less in his views on these subjects. Mr. Helstone thought the masters aggrieved, the workpeople unreasonable. He condemned sweepingly the widespread spirit of disaffection against constituted authorities, the growing indisposition to bear with patience evils he regarded as inevitable. The cures he prescribed were vigorous government interference, strict magisterial vigilance, when necessary, prompt military coercion. Mr. York wished to know whether this interference, vigilance, and coercion would feed those who were hungry, give work to those who wanted work, and whom no man would hire. He scouted the idea of inevitable evils.
He said public patience was a camel, on whose back the last Adam that could be born had already been laid, and that resistance was now a duty. The widespread spirit of disaffection against constituted authorities he regarded as the most promising sign of the times. The masters, he allowed, were truly aggrieved, but their main grievances had been heaped on them by a corrupt, base, and bloody government. These were Mr. York's epithets. Madmen like Pitt, demons like Castlereagh, mischievous idiots like Percival, were the tyrants, the curses of the country, the destroyers of her trade. It was their infatuated perseverance in an unjustifiable, a hopeless, a ruinous war, which had brought the nation to its present pass. It was their monstrously oppressive taxation, it was the infamous orders in council the originators of which deserved impeachment and the scaffold, if ever public men did that hung a millstone about England's neck. But where was the use of talking? He demanded. What chance was there of reason being heard in a land that was king-ridden, priest-ridden, peer-ridden, where a lunatic was the nominal monarch, an unprincipled debauchee the real ruler, where such an insult to common sense as hereditary legislators was tolerated, where such a humbug as a bench of bishops, such an arrogant abuse as a pampered, persecuting established church was endured and venerated, where a standing army was maintained, and a host of lazy parsons and their pauper families were kept on the fat of the land. Mr. Helstone, rising up and putting on his shovel hat, observed in reply, that in the course of his life he had met with two or three instances where sentiments of this sort had been very bravely maintained so long as health, strength, and worldly prosperity had been the allies of him who professed them, but there came a time, he said, to all men, when the keepers of the house should tremble, when they should be afraid of that which is high, and fear should be in the way, and that time was the test of the advocate of anarchy and rebellion, the enemy of religion and order. Ere now, he affirmed, he had been called upon to read those prayers our church has provided for the sick by the miserable dying bed of one of her most rancorous foes. He had seen such a one stricken with remorse, solicitous to discover a place for repentance, and unable to find any, though he sought it carefully with tears. He must forewarn Mr. York that blasphemy against God and the king was a deadly sin, and that there was such a thing as judgment to come. Mr. York believed fully that there was such a thing as judgment to come. If it were otherwise, it would be difficult to imagine how all the scoundrels who seemed triumphant in this world, who broke innocent hearts with impunity, abused unmerited privileges, were a scandal to honorable callings, took the bread out of the mouths of the poor, browbeat the humble, and truckled meanly to the rich and proud, were to be properly paid off in such coin as they had earned. But, he added, whenever he got low-spirited about such like goings-on, and their seeming success in this mucky lump of a planet, he just reached down to old book, pointing to a great Bible in the bookcase, opened it like at a chance, and he was sure to light of a verse blazing why a blue brimstone low that set all straight. He knew, he said, where some folk were bound for, just as weel as if an angel why great white wings had come in o'er T. Doorstone and told him. Sir, said Mr. Helstone, collecting all his dignity sir, the great knowledge of man is to know himself, and the born whither his own steps tend. You'll recollect, Mr. Helstone, that ignorance was carried away from the very gates of heaven, borne through the air, and thrust in at a door in the side of the hill which led down to hell. Nor have I forgotten, Mr. York, that vain confidence, not seeing the way before him, fell into a deep pit, which was on purpose there made by the prince of the grounds, to catch vainglorious fools withal, and was dashed to pieces with his fall. Now, interposed Mr. Moore, who had hitherto sat a silent but amused spectator of this worldly combat, and whose indifference to the party politics of the day, as well as to the gossip of the neighborhood, made him an impartial, if apathetic, judge of the merits of such an encounter. You have both sufficiently blackballed each other, and proved how cordially you detest each other, and how wicked you think each other. For my part, my hate is still running in such a strong current against the fellows who have broken my frames that I have none to spare for my private acquaintance, and still less for such a big thing as a sect or a government. But really, gentlemen, you both seem very bad by your own showing worse than ever I suspected you to be. I dare not stay all night with a rebel and blasphemer like you, York, and I hardly dare ride home with a cruel and tyrannical ecclesiastic like Mr. Helstone. I am going, however, Mr. Moore, said the rector sternly. Come with me or not, as you please. Nay, he shall not have the choice, he shall go with you, responded York. It's midnight, and past, and I'll have nobody staying up by my house any longer. Ye moon, I'll go. He rang the bell. Deb, said he to the servant who answered it, clear them folk out of tea kitchen, and lock tea doors,
and be off to bed. Here is your way, gentlemen, he continued to his guests, and, lighting them through the passage, he fairly put them out at his front door. They met their party hurrying out pell-mell by the back way. Their horses stood at the gate, they mounted, and rode off, more laughing at their abrupt dismissal, Hailstone deeply indignant thereat. Chapter 5. Hollow's Cottage. Moore's good spirits were still with him when he rose next morning. He and Joe Scott had both spent the night in the mill, availing themselves of certain sleeping accommodations producible from recesses in the front and back counting houses. The master, always an early riser, was up somewhat sooner even than usual. He awoke his man by singing a French song as he made his toilet. "Ye're not custened on, then, maester?" cried Joe. "Not a stiver, mon garçon," which means, "my lad. Get up, and we'll take a turn through the mill before the hands come in, and I'll explain my future plans. We'll have the machinery yet, Joseph. You never heard of Bruce, perhaps?"
"And T.H. Arend, Spider?"
"Yes, but I have. I've read T.H. History of Scotland, and happen na as michant as ye, and I understand ye to mean to say ye'll persevere."
"I do."
"Is there mony o' your mak o' your country?" inquired Joe, as he folded up his temporary bed, and put it away.
"In my country."
"Which is my country?"
"Why, France, isn't it?"
"Not it, indeed. The circumstance of the French having seized Antwerp, where I was born, does not make me a Frenchman."
"Holland, then?"
"I am not a Dutchman.
Now you are confounding Antwerp with Amsterdam."
"Flanders?"
"I scorn the insinuation, Joe. I a Flamand. Have I a Flemish face, the clumsy nose standing out, the mean forehead falling back, the pale blue eyes off fleur de tête? Am I all body and no legs, like a Flamand? But you don't know what they are like, those Netherlanders. Joe, I'm an Anversois. My mother was an Anversois, though she came of French lineage, which is the reason I speak French."
"But your father wore Yorkshire, which makes ye a bit Yorkshire too, and onybody may see ye're akin to us, ye're so keen a making brass, and getting forards."
"Joe, you're an impudent dog, but I've always been accustomed to a boorish sort of insolence from my youth up. The classe ouvrière, that is, the working people in Belgium, bear themselves brutally towards their employers, and by brutally, Joe, I mean brutalment, which, perhaps, when properly translated, should be roughly. We always speak our mind's eye this country, and them young parsons and grand folk fro London is shocked at their incivility, and we like weel enough to gie em summat to be shocked at, 'cause it's sport to us to watch em turn up the whites o' their ain, and spread out their bits o' hands, like as their flayed wy bogards, and then to hear em say, nipping off their words short like, 'Dear, dear, wets of edges. How very coarse.
You are savages, Joe. You don't suppose you're civilized, do you?"
"Middling, middling, maester. I reckon at us manufacturing lads ith north is a deal more intelligent, and nas a deal more nor th farming folk ith south. Trade sharpens fair wits, and then that's mechanics like me is forced to think. Ye know, what why looking after machinery and zish like, I've getten into that way that when I see an effect, I look straight out for a cause, and I oft like hold on to purpose, and then I like reading, and I'm curious to know what them that reckons to govern us aims to do for us and why us. And there is many cuter nor me, there's many a one among them greasy chaps that smells o' oil, and among them dyers wy blue and black skins, that has a long head, and that can tell what a fool of a law is, as well as year old York, and a deal better nor soft hunts like Christopher Sykes o' Winbury, and greed hectoring nouts like yond Irish Peter, Hailstone's curate.
You think yourself a clever fellow, I know, Scott.
Eh? I'm fairish. I can tell she's fro chalk, and I'm very weel aware that I've improved sish opportunities as I have had, a deal better nor some at reckons to be ad boon me, but there's thousands I Yorkshire that's as good as me, and a 2-3 that's better.
You're a great man, you're a sublime fellow, but you're a prig, a conceited noodle with it all, Joe. You need not to think that because you've picked up a little knowledge of practical mathematics, and because you have found some scantling of the elements of chemistry at the bottom of a dying vat, that therefore you're a neglected man of science, and you need not to suppose that because the course of trade does not always run smooth, and you, and such as you, are sometimes short of work and of bread, that therefore your class are martyrs, and that the whole form of government under which you live is wrong. And, moreover, you need not for a moment to insinuate that the virtues have taken refuge in cottages and wholly abandoned slated houses. Let me tell you, I particularly abominate that sort of trash, because I know so well that human nature is human nature everywhere,
whether under tile or thatch, and that in every specimen of human nature that breathes, vice and virtue are ever found blended, in smaller or greater proportions, and that the proportion is not determined by station. I have seen villains who were rich, and I have seen villains who were poor, and I have seen villains who were neither rich nor poor, but who had realized Agar's wish, and lived in fair and modest competency. The clock is going to strike six. Away with you, Cho, and ring the mill bell. It was now the middle of the month of February, by 6 o'clock therefore dawn was just beginning to steal on night, to penetrate with a pale ray its brown obscurity, and give a demi-translucence to its opaque shadows. Pale enough that ray was on this particular morning, no color tinged the east, no flush warmed it. To see what a heavy-lit day slowly lifted, what a wan glance she flung along the hills, you would have thought the sun's fire quenched in last night's floods. The breath of this morning was chill as its aspect, a raw wind stirred the massive night cloud, and showed, as it slowly rose, leaving a colorless, silver-gleaming ring all round the horizon, not blue sky, but a stratum of paler vapor beyond. It had ceased to rain, but the earth was sodden, and the pools and rivulets were full. The mill windows were alight, the bell still rung loud, and now the little children came running in too great a hurry, let us hope, to feel very much nipped by the inclement air, and indeed, by contrast, perhaps the morning appeared rather favorable to them than otherwise, for they had often come to their work that winter through snowstorms, through heavy rain, through hard frost. Mr. Moore stood at the entrance to watch them pass. He counted them as they went by. To those who came rather late he said a word of reprimand, which was a little more sharply repeated by Joe Scott when the lingerers reached the workrooms. Neither master nor overlooker spoke savagely. They were not savage men either of them, though it appeared both were rigid, for they fined a delinquent who came considerably too late. Mr. Moore made him pay his penny down ere he entered, and informed him that the next repetition of the fault would cost him tuppence. Rules, no doubt, are necessary in such cases, and coarse and cruel masters will make coarse and cruel rules, which, at the time we treat of at least, they used sometimes to enforce tyrannically, but though I describe imperfect characters, every character in this book will be found to be more or less imperfect, my pen refusing to draw anything in the model line, I have not undertaken to handle degraded or utterly infamous ones. Child torturers, slave masters and drivers, I consign to the hands of jailers. The novelist may be excused from sullying his page with the record of their deeds. Instead, then, of harrowing up my reader's soul and delighting his organ of wonder with effective descriptions of stripes and scourgings, I'm happy to be able to inform him that neither Mr. Moore nor his overlooker ever struck a child in their mill. Joe had, indeed, once very severely flogged a son of his own for telling a lie and persisting in it, but, like his employer, he was too phlegmatic, too calm, as well as too reasonable a man, to make corporal chastisement other than the exception to his treatment of the young. Mr. Moore haunted his mill, his mill yard, his dye house, and his warehouse till the sickly dawn strengthened into day. The sun even rose at least a white disk, clear, tintless, and almost chill-looking as ice, peeped over the dark crest of a hill, changed to silver the livid edge of the cloud above it, and looked solemnly down the whole length of the den, or narrow dale, to whose straight bounds we are at present limited. It was 8 o'clock, the mill lights were all extinguished, the signal was given for breakfast, the children, released for half an hour from toil, betook themselves to the little tin cans which held their coffee, and to the small baskets which contained their allowance of bread. Let us hope they have enough to eat, it would be a pity were it otherwise. And now at last Mr. Moore quitted the mill yard, and bent his steps to his dwelling house. It was only a short distance from the factory, but the hedge and high bank on each side of the lane which conducted to it seemed to give it something of the appearance and feeling of seclusion. It was a small, whitewashed place, with a green porch over the door, scanty brown stalks showed in the garden soil near this porch, and likewise beneath the windows stalks budless and flowerless now, but giving dim prediction of trained and blooming creepers for summer days. A grass plat and borders fronted the cottage. The borders presented only black mold yet, except where, in sheltered nooks, the first shoots of snowdrop or crocus peeped, green as emerald, from the earth. The spring was late, it had been a severe and prolonged winter, the last deep snow had but just disappeared before yesterday's rains, on the hills, indeed, white remnants of it yet gleamed, flecking the hollows and crowning the peaks, the lawn was not verdant, but bleached, as was the grass on the bank, and under the hedge in the lane. Three trees, gracefully grouped, rose beside the cottage. They were not lofty, but having no rivals near, they looked well and imposing where they grew.
Such was Mr. Moore's home, a snug nest for content and contemplation, but one within which the wings of action and ambition could not long lie folded. Its air of modest comfort seemed to possess no particular attraction for its owner. Instead of entering the house at once, he fetched a spade from a little shed and began to work in the garden. For about a quarter of an hour he dug on uninterrupted. At length, however, a window opened, and a female voice called to him, "Dash. Eh, bien. Tu need a chance passer matin?" The answer, and the rest of the conversation, was in French, but as this is an English book, I shall translate it into English. "Is breakfast ready, Hortense?" "Certainly, it has been ready half an hour." "Then I am ready too. I have a canine hunger." He threw down his spade, and entered the house. The narrow passage conducted him to a small parlor, where a breakfast of coffee and bread and butter, with a somewhat un-English accompaniment of stewed pears, was spread on the table. Over these viands presided the lady who had spoken from the window. I must describe her before I go any farther. She seemed a little older than Mr. Moore, perhaps she was 35, tall, and proportionately stout. She had very black hair, for the present twisted up in curled papers, a high color in her cheeks, a small nose, a pair of little black eyes. The lower part of her face was large in proportion to the upper, her forehead was small and rather corrugated, she had a fretful though not an ill-natured expression of countenance, there was something in her whole appearance one felt inclined to be half provoked with and half amused at. The strangest point was her dress, a stuff petticoat and a striped cotton camisole. The petticoat was short, displaying well a pair of feet and ankles which left much to be desired in the article of symmetry. You will think I have depicted a remarkable slattern, reader. Not at all. Hortense Moore, she was Mr. Moore's sister, was a very orderly, economical person. The petticoat, camisole, and curl papers were her morning costume, in which, of forenoons, she had always been accustomed to go her household ways in her own country. She did not choose to adopt English fashions because she was obliged to live in England, she adhered to her old Belgian modes, quite satisfied that there was a merit in so doing. Mademoiselle had an excellent opinion of herself, an opinion not wholly undeserved, for she possessed some good and sterling qualities, but she rather overestimated the kind and degree of these qualities, and quite left out of the account sundry little defects which accompanied them. You could never have persuaded her that she was a prejudiced and narrow-minded person, that she was too susceptible on the subject of her own dignity and importance, and too apt to take offense about trifles, yet all this was true. However, where her claims to distinction were not opposed, and where her prejudices were not offended, she could be kind and friendly enough. To her two brothers, for there was another Gérard Moore besides Robert, she was very much attached. As the sole remaining representatives of their decayed family, the persons of both were almost sacred in her eyes. Of Louis, however, she knew less than of Robert. He had been sent to England when a mere boy, and had received his education at an English school. His education not being such as to adapt him for trade, perhaps, too, his natural bent not inclining him to mercantile pursuits, he had, when the blight of hereditary prospects rendered it necessary for him to push his own fortune, adopted the very arduous and very modest career of a teacher. He had been usher in a school, and was said now to be tutor in a private family. Hortense, when she mentioned Louis, described him as having what she called des moyens, but as being too backward and quiet. Her praise of Robert was in a different strain, less qualified, she was very proud of him, she regarded him as the greatest man in Europe, all he said and did was remarkable in her eyes, and she expected others to behold him from the same point of view. Nothing could be more irrational, monstrous, and infamous than opposition from any quarter to Robert, unless it were opposition to herself. Accordingly, as soon as the said Robert was seated at the breakfast table, and she had helped him to a portion of stewed pears, and cut him a good-sized Belgian tartine, she began to pour out a flood of amazement and horror at the transaction of last night, the destruction of the frames. Quelle idée! To destroy them! Quelle action on to use! Envoyez bien que les ouvriers de ces pays étaient à la fois et méchant. C'était absolument comme les domestiques anglais, les servantes surtout, rien d'insupportable comme cette Sarah, par exemple. She looks clean and industrious, Mr. Moore remarked. Looks. I don't know how she looks, and I do not say that she is altogether dirty or idle, mais elle est d'une insolence. She disputed with me a quarter of an hour yesterday about the cooking of the beef, she said I boiled it to rags, that English people would never be able to eat such a dish as our bouilli, that the bouillon was no better than greasy warm water, and as to the choucroute, she affirms she cannot touch it.
That barrel we have in the cellar delightfully prepared by my own hands she termed a tub of hogwash, which means food for pigs. I am harassed with the girl, and yet I cannot part with her lest I should get a worse. You are in the same position with your workmen, pauvre cher frère. I am afraid you are not very happy in England, Hortense. It is my duty to be happy where you are, brother, but otherwise there are certainly a thousand things which make me regret our native town. All the world here appears to me ill bred, mal élevé. I find my habits considered ridiculous. If a girl out of your mill chances to come into the kitchen and find me in my japon and camisole preparing dinner, for you know I cannot trust Sarah to cook a single dish, she sneers. If I accept an invitation out to tea, which I have done once or twice, I perceive I am put quite into the background, I have not that attention paid me which decidedly is my due. Of what an excellent family are the Gerards, as we know, and the Moors also. They have a right to claim a certain respect, and to feel wounded when it is withheld from them. In Antwerp I was always treated with distinction, here, one would think that when I open my lips in company I speak English with a ridiculous accent, whereas I am quite assured that I pronounce it perfectly. Hortense, in Antwerp we were known rich, in England we were never known but poor. Precisely, and thus mercenary are mankind. Again, dear brother, last Sunday, if you recollect, was very wet, accordingly I went to church in my neat black sabot, objects one would not indeed wear in a fashionable city, but which in the country I have ever been accustomed to use for walking in dirty roads. Believe me, as I paced up the aisle, composed and tranquil, as I am always, four ladies, and as many gentlemen, laughed and hid their faces behind their prayer books. Well, well. Don't put on the sabot again. I told you before I thought they were not quite the thing for this country. But, brother, they are not common sabot, such as the peasantry wear. I tell you, they are sabot noir, tres pourpres, tres convenables. At Mons and Loos cities not very far removed from the elegant capital of Brussels it is very seldom that the respectable people wear anything else for walking in winter. Let anyone try to wade the mud of the Flemish chaussées in a pair of Paris brodequins, on Monterey de Nivelles. Never mind Mons and Loos in the Flemish chaussées, do it Rome as the Romans do. And as to the camisole and japon, I am not quite sure about them either. I never see an English lady dressed in such garments. Ask Caroline Hailstone. Caroline. I ask Caroline? I consult her about my dress? It is she who on all points should consult me. She is a child. She is 18, or at least 17, old enough to know all about gowns, petticoats, and chaussure. Do not spoil Caroline, I entreat you, brother. Do not make her of more consequence than she ought to be. At present she is modest and unassuming, let us keep her so. With all my heart. Is she coming this morning? She will come at 10, as usual, to take her French lesson. You don't find that she sneers at you, do you? She does not. She appreciates me better than anyone else here, but then she has more intimate opportunities of knowing me. She sees that I have education, intelligence, manner, principles all, in short, which belongs to a person well born and well bred. Are you at all fond of her? For fond I cannot say. I am not one who is prone to take violent fancies, and, consequently, my friendship is the more to be depended on. I have a regard for her as my relative, her position also inspires interest, and her conduct as my pupil has hitherto been such as rather to enhance than diminish the attachment that springs from other causes. She behaves pretty well at lessons? To me she behaves very well, but you are conscious, brother, that I have a manner calculated to repel over familiarity, to win esteem, and to command respect. Yet, possessed of penetration, I perceive clearly that Caroline is not perfect, that there is much to be desired in her. Give me a last cup of coffee, and while I am drinking it amuse me with an account of her faults. Dear brother, I am happy to see you eat your breakfast with relish, after the fatiguing night you have passed. Caroline, then, is defective, but with my forming hand and almost motherly care she may improve. There is about her an occasional something a reserve, I think which I do not quite like, because it is not sufficiently girlish and submissive, and there are glimpses of an unsettled hurry in her nature, which put me out. Yet she is usually most tranquil, too dejected and thoughtful indeed sometimes. In time, I doubt not, I shall make her uniformly sedate and decorous, without being unaccountably pensive. I ever disapprove what is not intelligible. I don't understand your account in the least. What do you mean by unsettled hurries, for instance? An example will, perhaps,
be the most satisfactory explanation. I sometimes, you are aware, make her read French poetry by way of practice in pronunciation. She has in the course of her lessons gone through much of Corneille and Racine, in a very steady, sober spirit, such as I approve. Occasionally she showed, indeed, a degree of languor in the perusal of those esteemed authors, partaking rather of apathy than sobriety, and apathy is what I cannot tolerate in those who have the benefit of my instructions. Besides, one should not be apathetic in studying standard works. The other day I put into her hands a volume of short fugitive pieces. I sent her to the window to learn one by heart, and when I looked up I saw her turning the leaves over impatiently, and curling her lip, absolutely with scorn, as she surveyed the little poems cursorily. I chid her. Ma cousine, said she, tout cela me à la mort. I told her this was improper language. View. She exclaimed, il n'y a donc pas de ligne de poésie dans toute la littérature française? I inquired what she meant. She begged my pardon with proper submission. Ere long she was still. I saw her smiling to herself over the book. She began to learn assiduously. In half an hour she came and stood before me, presented the volume, folded her hands, as I always require her to do, and commenced the repetition of that short thing by Shinya, La Jeune Captive. If you had heard the manner in which she went through this, and in which she uttered a few incoherent comments when she had done, you would have known what I meant by the phrase unsettled hurry. One would have thought Shinya was more moving than all Racine and all Corneille. You, brother, who have so much sagacity, will discern that this disproportionate preference argues an ill-regulated mind, but she is fortunate in her preceptress. I will give her a system, a method of thought, a set of opinions, I will give her the perfect control and guidance of her feelings. Be sure you do, Hortense. Here she comes. That was her shadow past the window, I believe. Ah. Truly. She is too early, half an hour before her time. My child, what brings you here before I have breakfasted? This question was addressed to an individual who now entered the room, a young girl, wrapped in a winter mantle, the folds of which were gathered with some grace round an apparently slender figure. I came in haste to see how you were, Hortense, and how Robert was too. I was sure you would be both grieved by what happened last night. I did not hear till this morning. My uncle told me at breakfast. Ah. It is unspeakable. You sympathize with us? Your uncle sympathizes with us? My uncle is very angry, but he was with Robert, I believe, was he not? Did he not go with you to Stillbrough Moor? Yes, we set out in very martial style, Caroline, but the prisoners we went to rescue met us halfway. Of course nobody was hurt? Why, no, only Joe Scott's wrists were a little galled with being pinioned too tightly behind his back. You were not there? You were not with the wagons when they were attacked? No. One seldom has the fortune to be present at occurrences at which one would particularly wish to assist. Where are you going this morning? I saw Murgatroyd saddling your horse in the yard. To Winbury. It is market day. Mr. York is going too. I met him in his gig. Come home with him. Why? Two are better than one, and nobody dislikes Mr. York at least, poor people do not dislike him. Therefore he would be a protection to me, who am hated. Who are misunderstood. That, probably, is the word. Shall you be late? Will he be late, Cousin Hortense? It is too probable. He has often much business to transact at Winbury. Have you brought your exercise book, child? Yes. What time will you return, Robert? I generally return at 7. Do you wish me to be at home earlier? Try rather to be back by 6. It is not absolutely dark at 6 now, but by 7 daylight is quite gone. And what danger is to be apprehended, Caroline, when daylight is gone? What peril do you conceive comes as the companion of darkness for me? I am not sure that I can define my fears, but we all have a certain anxiety at present about our friends. My uncle calls these times dangerous. He says, too, that mill owners are unpopular. And I am one of the most unpopular? Is not that the fact? You are reluctant to speak out plainly, but at heart you think me liable to Pearson's fate, who was shot at not, indeed, from behind a hedge, but in his own house, through his staircase window, as he was going to bed. And Pearson showed me the bullet in the chamber door, remarked Caroline gravely, as she folded her mantle and arranged it in her muff on a side table. You know, she continued, there is a hedge all the way along the road from here to Winbury, and there are the field head plantations to pass, but you will be back by 6 or before? Certainly he will,
affirmed Hortense. And now, my child, prepare your lessons for repetition, while I put the peas to soak for the puree at dinner. With this direction she left the room. You suspect I have many enemies, then, Caroline, said Mr. Moore, and doubtless you know me to be destitute of friends?
Not destitute, Robert. There is your sister, your brother Louis, whom I have never seen, there is Mr. York, and there is my uncle besides, of course, many more.
Robert smiled. You would be puzzled to name your many more, said he. But show me your exercise book. What extreme pains you take with the writing. My sister, I suppose, exacts this care. She wants to form you in all things after the model of a Flemish schoolgirl. What life are you destined for, Caroline? What will you do with your French, drawing, and other accomplishments, when they are acquired? You may well say, when they are acquired, for, as you are aware, till Hortense began to teach me, I knew precious little. As to the life I am destined for, I cannot tell. I suppose to keep my uncle's house till, she hesitated.
Till what? Till he dies?
No. How harsh to say that. I never think of his dying. He is only 55. But till, in short, till events offer other occupations for me. A remarkably vague prospect. Are you content with it?
I used to be, formerly.
Children, you know, have little reflection, or rather their reflections run on ideal themes. There are moments now when I am not quite satisfied.
Why?
I am making no money, earning nothing.
You come to the point, Lena. You too, then, wish to make money?
I do. I should like an occupation, and if I were a boy, it would not be so difficult to find one. I see such an easy, pleasant way of learning a business, and making my way in life.
Go on. Let us hear what way.
I could be apprenticed to your trade, the cloth trade. I could learn it of you, as we are distant relations. I would do the counting housework, keep the books, and write the letters, while you went to market. I know you greatly desire to be rich, in order to pay your father's debts. Perhaps I could help you to get rich.
Help me? You should think of yourself.
I do think of myself, but must one forever think only of oneself?
Of whom else do I think? Of whom else dare I think?
The poor ought to have no large sympathies, it is their duty to be narrow.
No, Robert.
Yes, Caroline. Poverty is necessarily selfish, contracted, groveling, anxious. Now and then a poor man's heart, when certain beams and dews visit it, may smell like the budding vegetation in yonder garden on this spring day, may feel ripe to evolve in foliage, perhaps blossom, but he must not encourage the pleasant impulse, he must invoke prudence to check it, with that frosty breath of hers, which is as nipping as any north wind.
No cottage would be happy then.
When I speak of poverty, I do not so much mean the natural, habitual poverty of the working man, as the embarrassed penury of the man in debt. My grubworm is always a straitened, struggling, careworn tradesman.
Cherish hope, not anxiety. Certain ideas have become too fixed in your mind. It may be presumptuous to say it, but I have the impression that there is something wrong in your notions of the best means of attaining happiness, as there is in, second hesitation.
I'm all ear, Caroline.
In, courage. Let me speak the truth, in your manner mind, I say only manner to these Yorkshire work people.
You have often wanted to tell me that, have you not?
Yes, often, very often.
The faults of my manner are, I think, only negative. I am not proud. What has a man in my position to be proud of? I'm only taciturn, phlegmatic, and joyless. As if your living cloth dressers were all machines like your frames and shears. In your own house you seem different.
To those of my own house I am no alien, which I am to these English clowns. I might act the benevolent with them, but acting is not my forte. I find them irrational, perverse, they hinder me when I long to hurry forward. In treating them justly I fulfill my whole duty towards them.
You don't expect them to love you, of course?
Nor wish it.
Ah, said the monitress, shaking her head and heaving a deep sigh. With this ejaculation, indicative that she perceived a screw to be loose somewhere, but that it was out of her reach to set it right, she bent over her grammar, and sought the rule and exercise for the day. I suppose I am not an affectionate man, Caroline. The attachment of a very few suffices me.
If you please, Robert, will you mend me a pen or two before you go?
First let me rule your book, for you always contrive to draw the lines aslant.
There now. And now for the pens. You like a fine one, I think?
such as you generally make for me in Hortense, not your own broad points. If I were of Louis' calling, I might stay at home and dedicate this morning to you and your studies, whereas I must spend it in Skies's wool warehouse. You will be making money. More likely losing it. As he finished mending the pens, a horse, saddled and bridled, was brought up to the garden gate. There, Fred is ready for me, I must go. I'll take one look to see what the spring has done in the south border, too, first. He quitted the room, and went out into the garden ground behind the mill. A sweet fringe of young verdure and opening flowers, snowdrop, crocus, even primrose bloomed in the sunshine under the hot wall of the factory. More plucked here and there a blossom and leaf, till he had collected a little bouquet. He returned to the parlor, pilfered a thread of silk from his sister's workbasket, tied the flowers, and laid them on Caroline's desk. Now, good morning.
Thank you, Robert.
It is pretty, it looks, as it lies there, like sparkles of sunshine and blue sky. Good morning. He went to the door, stopped, opened his lips as if to speak, said nothing, and moved on. He passed through the wicket, and mounted his horse. In a second he had flung himself from his saddle again, transferred the reins to Murgatroyd, and re-entered the cottage. I forgot my gloves, he said, appearing to take something from the side table. Then, as an impromptu thought, he remarked, you have no binding engagement at home perhaps, Caroline?
I never have.
Some children's socks, which Mrs. Ramsden has ordered, to knit for the Jew's basket, but they will keep.
Jew's basket be sold. Never was utensil better named. Anything more Jewish than it, its contents and their prices cannot be conceived. But I see something, a very tiny curl, at the corners of your lip, which tells me that you know its merits as well as I do. Forget the Jew's basket, then, and spend the day here as a change. Your uncle won't break his heart at your absence?
She smiled. No.
The old Cossack.
I dare say not, muttered Moore. Then stay and dine with Hortense, she will be glad of your company. I shall return in good time. We will have a little reading in the evening. The moon rises at 8:30, and I will walk up to the rectory with you at 9. Do you agree? She nodded her head, and her eyes lit up. Moore lingered yet 2 minutes. He bent over Caroline's desk and glanced at her grammar, he fingered her pen, he lifted her bouquet and played with it, his horse stamped impatient, Fred Murgatroyd hemmed and coughed at the gate, as if he wondered what in the world his master was doing. Good morning, again said Moore, and finally vanished. Hortense, coming in 10 minutes after, found, to her surprise, that Caroline had not yet commenced her exercise. Chapter 6. Coriolanus. Mademoiselle Moore had that morning a somewhat absent-minded pupil. Caroline forgot, again and again, the explanations which were given to her. However, she still bore with unclouded mood the chidings her inattention brought upon her. Sitting in the sunshine near the window, she seemed to receive with its warmth a kind influence, which made her both happy and good. Thus disposed, she looked her best, and her best was a pleasing vision. To her had not been denied the gift of beauty. It was not absolutely necessary to know her in order to like her, she was fair enough to please, even at the first view. Her shape suited her age, it was girlish, light, and pliant, every curve was neat, every limb proportionate, her face was expressive and gentle, her eyes were handsome, and gifted at times with a winning beam that stole into the heart, with a language that spoke softly to the affections. Her mouth was very pretty, she had a delicate skin, and a fine flow of brown hair, which she knew how to arrange with taste. Curls became her, and she possessed them in picturesque profusion. Her style of dress announced taste in the wearer, very unobtrusive in fashion, far from costly in material, but suitable in color to the fair complexion with which it contrasted, and in make to the slight form which it draped. Her present winter garb was of merino, the same soft shade of brown as her hair, the little collar round her neck lay over a pink ribbon, and was fastened with a pink knot. She wore no other decoration. So much for Caroline Helstone's appearance. As to her character or intellect, if she had any, they must speak for themselves in due time. Her connections are soon explained. She was the child of parents separated soon after her birth, in consequence of disagreement of disposition. Her mother was the half-sister of Mr. Moore's father, thus, though there was no mixture of blood, she was, in a distant sense, the cousin of Robert, Louis, and Hortense. Her father was the brother of Mr. Helstone, a man of the character friends desire not to recall, after death has once settled all earthly accounts. He had rendered his wife unhappy.
The reports which were known to be true concerning him had given an air of probability to those which were falsely circulated respecting his better principled brother. Caroline had never known her mother, as she was taken from her in infancy, and had not since seen her. Her father died comparatively young, and her uncle, the rector, had for some years been her sole guardian. He was not, as we are aware, much adapted, either by nature or habits, to have the charge of a young girl. He had taken little trouble about her education, probably he would have taken none if she, finding herself neglected, had not grown anxious on her own account, and asked, every now and then, for a little attention, and for the means of acquiring such amount of knowledge as could not be dispensed with. Still, she had a depressing feeling that she was inferior, that her attainments were fewer than were usually possessed by girls of her age and station, and very glad was she to avail herself of the kind offer made by her cousin Hortense, soon after the arrival of the latter at Hollows Mill, to teach her French and fine needlework. More, for her part, delighted in the task, because it gave her importance, she liked to lord it a little over a docile yet quick pupil. She took Caroline precisely at her own estimate, as an irregularly taught, even ignorant girl, and when she found that she made rapid and eager progress, it was to no talent, no application, in the scholar she ascribed the improvement, but entirely to her own superior method of teaching. When she found that Caroline, unskilled in routine, had a knowledge of her own, desultory but varied, the discovery caused her no surprise, for she still imagined that from her conversation had the girl unawares gleaned these treasures. She thought it even when forced to feel that her pupil knew much on subjects whereof she knew little. The idea was not logical, but Hortense had perfect faith in it. Mademoiselle, who prided herself on possessing un esprit positif, and on entertaining a decided preference for dry studies, kept her young cousin to the same as closely as she could. She worked her unrelentingly at the grammar of the French language, assigning her, as the most improving exercise she could devise, interminable analyses logiques. These analyses were by no means a source of particular pleasure to Caroline, she thought she could have learned French just as well without them, and grudged excessively the time spent in pondering over propositions, principales, et incidentes, in deciding the incidente determinative, and the incidente applicative, in examining whether the proposition was plan, elliptic, or implicit. Sometimes she lost herself in the maze, and when so lost she would, now and then, while Hortense was rummaging her drawers upstairs, an unaccountable occupation in which she spent a large portion of each day, arranging, disarranging, rearranging, and counter-arranging, carry her book to Robert in the counting house, and get the rough place made smooth by his aid. Mr. Moore possessed a clear, tranquil brain of his own. Almost as soon as he looked at Caroline's little difficulties, they seemed to dissolve beneath his eye. In 2 minutes he would explain all, in 2 words give the key to the puzzle. She thought if Hortense could only teach like him, how much faster she might learn. Repaying him by an admiring and grateful smile, rather shed at his feet than lifted to his face, she would leave the mill reluctantly to go back to the cottage, and then, while she completed the exercise, or worked out the sum, Moore taught her arithmetic too, she would wish nature had made her a boy instead of a girl, that she might ask Robert to let her be his clerk, and sit with him in the counting house, instead of sitting with Hortense in the parlor. Occasionally, but this happened very rarely, she spent the evening at Hollow's cottage. Sometimes during these visits Moore was away attending a market, sometimes he was gone to Mr. York's, often he was engaged with a male visitor in another room, but sometimes, too, he was at home, disengaged, free to talk with Caroline. When this was the case, the evening hours passed on wings of light, they were gone before they were counted. There was no room in England so pleasant as that small parlor when the three cousins occupied it. Hortense, when she was not teaching, or scolding, or cooking, was far from ill-humored, it was her custom to relax towards evening, and to be kind to her young English kinswoman. There was a means, too, of rendering her delightful, by inducing her to take her guitar and sing and play. She then became quite good-natured. And as she played with skill, and had a well-toned voice, it was not disagreeable to listen to her. It would have been absolutely agreeable, except that her formal and self-important character modulated her strains, as it impressed her manners and molded her countenance. Mr. Moore, released from the business yoke, was, if not lively himself, a willing spectator of Caroline's liveliness, a complacent listener to her talk, a ready respondent to her questions. He was something agreeable to sit near, to hover round, to address and look at. Sometimes he was better than this, almost animated, quite gentle and friendly. The drawback was that by the next morning he was sure to be frozen up again,
and however much he seemed, in his quiet way, to enjoy these social evenings, he rarely contrived their recurrence. This circumstance puzzled the inexperienced head of his cousin. "If I had a means of happiness at my command," she thought, "I would employ that means often. I would keep it bright with use, and not let it lie for weeks aside, till it gets rusty." Yet she was careful not to put in practice her own theory. Much as she liked an evening visit to the cottage, she never paid one unasked. Often, indeed, when pressed by Hortense to come, she would refuse, because Robert did not second, or but slightly seconded the request. This morning was the first time he had ever, of his own unprompted will, given her an invitation, and then he had spoken so kindly that in hearing him she had received a sense of happiness sufficient to keep her glad for the whole day. The morning passed as usual. Mademoiselle, ever breathlessly busy, spent it in bustling from kitchen to parlor, now scolding Sarah, now looking over Caroline's exercise or hearing her repetition lesson. However faultlessly these tasks were achieved, she never commended. It was a maxim with her that praise is inconsistent with a teacher's dignity, and that blame, in more or less unqualified measure, is indispensable to it. She thought incessant reprimand, severe or slight, quite necessary to the maintenance of her authority, and if no possible error was to be found in the lesson, it was the pupil's carriage, or air, or dress, or mien, which required correction. The usual affray took place about the dinner, which meal, when Sarah at last brought it into the room, she almost flung upon the table, with a look that expressed quite plainly, "I never dished such stuff in my life afore, it's not fit for dogs." Notwithstanding Sarah's scorn, it was a savory repast enough. The soup was a sort of puree of dried peas, which Mademoiselle had prepared amidst bitter lamentations that in this desolate country of England no haricot beans were to be had. Then came a dish of meat nature unknown, but supposed to be miscellaneous, singularly chopped up with crumbs of bread, seasoned uniquely though not unpleasantly, and baked in a mold, a queer but by no means unpalatable dish. Greens, oddly bruised, formed the accompanying vegetable, and a pâté of fruit, conserved after a recipe devised by Madame Gérard Moore's grand-mère, and from the taste of which it appeared probable that melisse had been substituted for sugar, completed the dinner. Caroline had no objection to this Belgian cookery, indeed she rather liked it for a change, and it was well she did so, for had she evinced any disrelish thereof, such manifestation would have injured her in Mademoiselle's good graces forever. A positive crime might have been more easily pardoned than a symptom of distaste for the foreign comestibles. Soon after dinner Caroline coaxed her governess cousin upstairs to dress. This maneuver required management. To have hinted that the japon, camisole, and curl papers were odious objects, or indeed other than quite meritorious points, would have been a felony. Any premature attempt to urge their disappearance was therefore unwise, and would be likely to issue in the persevering wear of them during the whole day. Carefully avoiding rocks and quicksands, however, the pupil, on pretense of requiring a change of scene, contrived to get the teacher aloft, and, once in the bedroom, she persuaded her that it was not worth while returning thither, and that she might as well make her toilet now, and while Mademoiselle delivered a solemn homily on her own surpassing merit in disregarding all frivolities of fashion, Caroline denuded her of the camisole, invested her with a decent gown, arranged her collar, hair, etc., and made her quite presentable. But Hortense would put the finishing touches herself, and these finishing touches consisted in a thick handkerchief tied round the throat, and a large, servant-like black apron, which spoiled everything. On no account would Mademoiselle have appeared in her own house without the thick handkerchief and the voluminous apron. The first was a positive matter of morality; it was quite improper not to wear a fichu. The second was the ensign of a good housewife; she appeared to think that by means of it she somehow effected a large saving in her brother's income. She had, with her own hands, made and presented to Caroline similar equipments, and the only serious quarrel they had ever had, and which still left a soreness in the elder cousin's soul, had arisen from the refusal of the younger one to accept of and profit by these elegant presents. "I wear a high dress and a collar," said Caroline, "and I should feel suffocated with a handkerchief in addition, and my short aprons do quite as well as that very long one. I would rather make no change." Yet Hortense, by dint of perseverance, would probably have compelled her to make a change, had not Mr. Moore chanced to overhear a dispute on the subject, and decided that Caroline's little aprons would suffice, and that, in his opinion, as she was still but a child, she might for the present dispense with the fichu, especially as her curls were long, and almost touched her shoulders. There was no appeal against Robert's opinion, therefore his sister was compelled to yield,
but she disapproved entirely of the piquant neatness of Caroline's costume, and the ladylike grace of her appearance. Something more solid and homely she would have considered beaucoup plus convenable. The afternoon was devoted to sewing. Mademoiselle, like most Belgian ladies, was specially skillful with her needle. She by no means thought it waste of time to devote unnumbered hours to fine embroidery, sight-destroying lacework, marvelous netting and knitting, and, above all, to most elaborate stocking mending. She would give a day to the mending of two holes in a stocking any time, and think her mission nobly fulfilled when she had accomplished it. It was another of Caroline's troubles to be condemned to learn this foreign style of darning, which was done stitch by stitch, so as exactly to imitate the fabric of the stocking itself, a wear-a-few process, but considered by Hortense Gerard, and by her ancestresses before her for long generations back, as one of the first duties of a woman. She herself had had a needle, cotton, and a fearfully torn stocking put into her hand while she yet wore a child's coif on her little black head. Her oeuvre as in the darning line had been exhibited to company ere she was 6 years old, and when she first discovered that Caroline was profoundly ignorant of this most essential of attainments, she could have wept with pity over her miserably neglected youth. No time did she lose in seeking up a hopeless pair of hose, of which the heels were entirely gone, and in setting the ignorant English girl to repair the deficiency. This task had been commenced 2 years ago, and Caroline had the stockings in her work bag yet. She did a few rows every day, by way of penance for the expiation of her sins. They were a grievous burden to her, she would much have liked to put them in the fire, and once Mr. Moore, who had observed her sitting and sighing over them, had proposed a private incremation in the counting house, but to this proposal Caroline knew it would have been impolitic to accede. The result could only be a fresh pair of hose, probably in worse condition. She adhered, therefore, to the ills she knew. All the afternoon the two ladies sat and sewed, till the eyes and fingers, and even the spirits of one of them, were weary. The sky since dinner had darkened, it had begun to rain again, to pour fast. Secret fears began to steal on Caroline that Robert would be persuaded by Mr. Sykes or Mr. York to remain at Winbury till it cleared, and of that there appeared no present chance. 5 o'clock struck, and time stole on, still the clouds streamed. A sighing wind whispered in the roof trees of the cottage, day seemed already closing, the parlor fire shed on the clear hearth the glow ruddy as of twilight. "It will not be fair till the moon rises," pronounced Mademoiselle Moore, "consequently I feel assured that my brother will not return till then. Indeed I should be sorry if he did. We will have coffee. It would be vain to wait for him. I am tired. May I leave my work now, cousin?" "You may, since it grows too dark to see to do it well. Fold it up, put it carefully in your bag, then step into the kitchen and desire Sarah to bring in the goûter, or tea, as you call it. But it has not yet struck six. He may still come." "He will not, I tell you. I can calculate his movements. I understand my brother. Suspense is irksome, disappointment bitter. All the world has, some time or other, felt that." Caroline, obedient to orders, passed into the kitchen. Sarah was making a dress for herself at the table. "You are to bring in coffee," said the young lady in a spiritless tone, and then she leaned her arm and head against the kitchen mantelpiece, and hung listlessly over the fire. "How low you seem, miss. But it's all because your cousin keeps you so close to work. It's a shame." "Nothing of the kind, Sarah," was the brief reply. "Oh. But I know it is. You're fit to cry just this minute, for nothing else but because you've sat still the whole day. It would make a kitten dull to be mewed up so. Sarah, does your master often come home early from market when it is wet?"
"Never, hardly, but just today, for some reason, he has made a difference."
"What do you mean?"
"He is come. I'm certain I saw Murgatroyd lead his horse into the yard by the back way, when I went to get some water at the pump 5 minutes since. He was in the counting house with Joe Scott, I believe."
"You are mistaken."
"What should I be mistaken for? I know his horse surely."
"But you did not see himself?"
"I heard him speak, though. He was saying something to Joe Scott about having settled all concerning ways and means, and that there would be a new set of frames in the mill before another week passed, and that this time he would get 4 soldiers from Stillborough Barracks to guard the wagon."
"Sarah, are you making a gown?"
"Yes. Is it a handsome one?"
"Beautiful. Get the coffee ready. I'll finish cutting out that sleeve for you, and I'll give you some trimming for it. I have some narrow satin ribbon of a color that will just match it."
"You're very kind, miss.
Be quick, there's a good girl. But first put your master's shoes on the hearth,
He will take his boots off when he comes in.
I hear him, he is coming.
Miss, you are cutting the stuff wrong.
So I am, but it is only a snip. There is no harm done.
The kitchen door opened, Mr. Moore entered, very wet and cold. Caroline half turned from her dressmaking occupation, but renewed it for a moment, as if to gain a minute's time for some purpose. Bent over the dress, her face was hidden, there was an attempt to settle her features and veil their expression, which failed. When she at last met Mr. Moore, her countenance beamed.
We had ceased to expect you. They asserted you would not come, she said.
But I promised to return soon.
You expected me, I suppose?
No, Robert, I dared not when it rained so fast. And you are wet and chilled. Change everything. If you took cold, we should blame ourselves in some measure.
I am not wet through, my riding coat is waterproof. Dry shoes are all I require.
There the fire is pleasant after facing the cold wind and rain for a few miles.
He stood on the kitchen hearth, Caroline stood beside him.
Mr. Moore, while enjoying the genial glow, kept his eyes directed towards the glittering brasses on the shelf above. Chancing for an instant to look down, his glance rested on an uplifted face, flushed, smiling, happy, shaded with silky curls, lit with fine eyes. Sarah was gone into the parlor with a tray, a lecture from her mistress detained her there. Moore placed his hand a moment on his young cousin's shoulder, stooped, and left a kiss on her forehead.
Oh! Said she, as if the action had unsealed her lips, I was miserable when I thought you would not come. I am almost too happy now.
Are you happy, Robert? Do you like to come home?
I think I do tonight, at least.
Are you certain you are not fretting about your frames, and your business, and the war?
Not just now.
Are you positive you don't feel Hollow's cottage too small for you, and narrow, and dismal?
At this moment, no.
Can you affirm that you are not bitter at heart because rich and great people forget you?
No more questions. You are mistaken if you think I am anxious to curry favor with rich and great people. I only want means a position a career.
Which your own talent and goodness shall win you.
You are made to be great, you shall be great.
I wonder now, if you spoke honestly out of your heart, what recipe you would give me for acquiring this same greatness, but I know it better than you know it yourself.
Would it be efficacious?
Would it work?
Yes, poverty, misery, bankruptcy.
Oh, life is not what you think it, Lena.
But you are what I think you.
I am not.
You are better, then?
Far worse.
No, far better.
I know you are good.
How do you know it?
You look so, and I feel you are so.
Where do you feel it?
In my heart.
Ah. You judge me with your heart, Lena, you should judge me with your head.
I do, and then I am quite proud of you.
Robert, you cannot tell all my thoughts about you.
Mr. Moore's dark face mustered color, his lips smiled, and yet were compressed, his eyes laughed, and yet he resolutely knit his brow.
Think meanly of me, Lena, said he.
Men, in general, are a sort of scum, very different to anything of which you have an idea. I make no pretension to be better than my fellows.
If you did, I should not esteem you so much.
It is because you are modest that I have such confidence in your merit.
Are you flattering me?
He demanded, turning sharply upon her, and searching her face with an eye of acute penetration.
No, she said softly, laughing at his sudden quickness. She seemed to think it unnecessary to proffer any eager disavowal of the charge.
You don't care whether I think you flatter me or not?
No.
You are so secure of your own intentions?
I suppose so.
What are they, Caroline?
Only to ease my mind by expressing for once part of what I think, and then to make you better satisfied with yourself.
By assuring me that my kinswoman is my sincere friend?
Just so.
I am your sincere friend, Robert.
And I am what chance and change shall make me, Lena.
Not my enemy, however?
The answer was cut short by Sarah and her mistress entering the kitchen together in some commotion. They had been improving the time which Mr. Moore and Miss Helstone had spent in dialogue by a short dispute on the subject of café au lait, which Sarah said was the queerest mess she ever saw, and a waste of God's good gifts, as it was the nature of coffee to be boiled in water, and which Mademoiselle affirmed to be un breuvage royal, a thousand times too good for the mean person who objected to it. The former occupants of the kitchen now withdrew into the parlor. Before Hortense followed them thither, Caroline had only time again to question, not my enemy, Robert? And Moore, Quaker-like, had replied with another query, could I be?
and then, seating himself at the table, had settled Caroline at his side. Caroline scarcely heard Mademoiselle's explosion of wrath when she rejoined them. The long declamation about the conduite indigne de cette maison créateur sounded in her ear as confusedly as the agitated rattling of the china. Robert laughed a little at it, in very subdued sort, and then, politely and calmly entreating his sister to be tranquil, assured her that if it would yield her any satisfaction, she should have her choice of an attendant amongst all the girls in his mill. Only he feared they would scarcely suit her, as they were most of them, he was informed, completely ignorant of household work, and pert and self-willed as Sarah was, she was, perhaps, no worse than the majority of the women of her class. Mademoiselle admitted the truth of this conjecture. According to her, ces paysans anglais étaient tout insupportables. What would she not give for some bonne cuisinière en verses, with a high cap, short petticoat, and decent sabots proper to her class, something better, indeed, than an insolent coquette in a flounced gown, and absolutely without cap. For Sarah, it appears, did not partake the opinion of St. Paul that it is a shame for a woman to go with her head uncovered, but, holding rather a contrary doctrine, resolutely refused to imprison in linen or muslin the plentiful tresses of her yellow hair, which it was her wont to fasten up smartly with a comb behind, and on Sundays to wear curled in front. "Shall I try and get you an Antwerp girl?" asked Mr. Moore, who, stern in public, was on the whole very kind in private. "Merci du cadeau," was the answer. "An Antwerp girl would not stay here 10 days, sneered at as she would be by all the young coquine in your factory," then softening, "You are very good, dear brother, excuse my petulance, but truly my domestic trials are severe, yet they are probably my destiny, for I recollect that our revered mother experienced similar sufferings, though she had the choice of all the best servants in Antwerp. Domestics are in all countries a spoiled and unruly set." Mr. Moore had also certain reminiscences about the trials of his revered mother. A good mother she had been to him, and he honored her memory, but he recollected that she kept a hot kitchen of it in Antwerp, just as his faithful sister did here in England. Thus, therefore, he let the subject drop, and when the coffee service was removed, proceeded to console Hortense by fetching her music book and guitar, and having arranged the ribbon of the instrument round her neck with a quiet fraternal kindness he knew to be all-powerful in soothing her most ruffled moods, he asked her to give him some of their mother's favorite songs. "Nothing refines like affection. Family jarring vulgarizes, family union elevates." Hortense, pleased with her brother, and grateful to him, looked, as she touched her guitar, almost graceful, almost handsome. Her everyday fretful look was gone for a moment, and was replaced by a sourire plein de bonté. She sang the songs he asked for, with feeling. They reminded her of a parent to whom she had been truly attached, they reminded her of her young days. She observed, too, that Caroline listened with naive interest, this augmented her good humor, and the exclamation at the close of the song, "I wish I could sing and play like Hortense," achieved the business, and rendered her charming for the evening. It is true a little lecture to Caroline followed, on the vanity of wishing and the duty of trying. As Rome, it was suggested, had not been built in a day, so neither had Mademoiselle Gerard Moore's education been completed in a week, or by merely wishing to be clever. It was effort that had accomplished that great work. She was ever remarkable for her perseverance, for her industry. Her masters had remarked that it was as delightful as it was uncommon to find so much talent united with so much solidity, and so on. Once on the theme of her own merits, Mademoiselle was fluent. Cradled at last in blissful self-complacency, she took her knitting, and sat down tranquil. Drawn curtains, a clear fire, a softly shining lamp, gave now to the little parlor its best, its evening charm. It is probable that the three there present felt this charm. They all looked happy. "What shall we do now, Caroline?" asked Mr. Moore, returning to his seat beside his cousin. "What shall we do, Robert?" repeated she playfully. "You decide." "Not play at chess?"
"No."
"Nor draughts, nor backgammon?"
"No, no, we both hate silent games that only keep one's hands employed, don't we?"
"I believe we do." "Then shall we talk scandal?"
"About whom?"
"Are we sufficiently interested in anybody to take a pleasure in pulling their character to pieces?"
"A question that comes to the point. For my part, unamiable as it sounds, I must say no."
"And I too. But it is strange, though we want no third fourth, I mean," she hastily and with contrition glanced at Hortense, "living person among us so selfish we are in our happiness though we don't want to think of the present existing world, it would be pleasant to go back to the past,
To hear people that have slept for generations in graves that are perhaps no longer graves now, but gardens and fields, speak to us and tell us their thoughts, and impart their ideas. Who shall be the speaker? What language shall he utter? French? Your French forefathers don't speak so sweetly, nor so solemnly, nor so impressively as your English ancestors, Robert. Tonight you shall be entirely English. You shall read an English book.
An old English book?
Yes, an old English book, one that you like, and I will choose a part of it that is toned quite in harmony with something in you. It shall waken your nature, fill your mind with music, it shall pass like a skillful hand over your heart, and make its strings sound. Your heart is a lyre, Robert, but the lot of your life has not been a minstrel to sweep it, and it is often silent. Let glorious William come near and touch it. You will see how he will draw the English power and melody out of its chords.
I must read Shakespeare?
You must have his spirit before you, you must hear his voice with your mind's ear, you must take some of his soul into yours.
With a view to making me better?
Is it to operate like a sermon?
It is to stir you, to give you new sensations.
It is to make you feel your life strongly, not only your virtues, but your vicious, perverse points.
View. Que dit-elle?
Cried Hortense, who hitherto had been counting stitches in her knitting, and had not much attended to what was said, but whose ear these two strong words caught with a tweak.
Never mind her, sister, let her talk. Now just let her say anything she pleases tonight. She likes to come down hard upon your brother sometimes. It amuses me, so let her alone.
Caroline, who, mounted on a chair, had been rummaging the bookcase, returned with a book.
Here's Shakespeare, she said, and there's Coriolanus. Now, read, and discover by the feelings the reading will give you at once how low and how high you are.
Come, then, sit near me, and correct when I mispronounce.
I am to be the teacher then, and you my pupil?
Ansi, Swa'il.
And Shakespeare is our science, since we are going to study?
It appears so.
And you are not going to be French, and skeptical, and sneering? You are not going to think it a sign of wisdom to refuse to admire?
I don't know.
If you do, Robert, I'll take Shakespeare away, and I'll shrivel up within myself, and put on my bonnet and go home.
Sit down. Here I begin.
1 minute, if you please, brother, interrupted Mademoiselle. When the gentleman of a family reads, the ladies should always sew.
Caroline, dear child, take your embroidery. You may get 3 sprigs done tonight.
Caroline looked dismayed.
I can't see by lamplight, my eyes are tired, and I can't do 2 things well at once. If I sew, I cannot listen, if I listen, I cannot sew.
Fie, dunk. Calinfantillage. Began Hortense.
Mr. Moore, as usual, suavely interposed.
Permit her to neglect the embroidery for this evening. I wish her whole attention to be fixed on my accent, and to ensure this, she must follow the reading with her eyes, she must look at the book.
He placed it between them, reposed his arm on the back of Caroline's chair, and thus began to read. The very first scene in Coriolanus came with smart relish to his intellectual palate, and still as he read he warmed. He delivered the haughty speech of Caius Marcius to the starving citizens with unction. He did not say he thought his irrational pride right, but he seemed to feel it so.
Caroline looked up at him with a singular smile.
There's a vicious point hit already, she said. You sympathize with that proud patrician who does not sympathize with his famished fellow men, and insults them.
There, go on.
He proceeded. The warlike portions did not rouse him much, he said all that was out of date, or should be, the spirit displayed was barbarous, yet the encounter single-handed between Marcius and Tullus Aufidius he delighted in. As he advanced, he forgot to criticize, it was evident he appreciated the power, the truth of each portion, and, stepping out of the narrow line of private prejudices, began to revel in the large picture of human nature, to feel the reality stamped upon the characters who were speaking from that page before him. He did not read the comic scenes well, and Caroline, taking the book out of his hand, read these parts for him. From her he seemed to enjoy them, and indeed she gave them with a spirit no one could have expected of her, with a pithy expression with which she seemed gifted on the spot, and for that brief moment only. It may be remarked, in passing, that the general character of her conversation that evening, whether serious or sprightly, grave or gay, was as of something untaught, unstudied, intuitive, fitful when once gone, no more to be reproduced as it had been than the glancing ray of the meteor, than the tints of the dew gem, than the color or form of the sunset cloud, than the fleeting and glittering ripple varying the flow of the rivulet.
Coriolanus in glory, Coriolanus in disaster, Coriolanus banished, followed like giant shades one after the other. Before the vision of the banished man, Moore's spirit seemed to pause. He stood on the hearth of Aufidius's hall, facing the image of greatness fallen, but greater than ever in that low estate. He saw the grim appearance, the dark face bearing command in it, the noble vessel with its tackle torn. With the revenge of Caius Marcius, Moore perfectly sympathized, he was not scandalized by it, and again Caroline whispered, "There I see another glimpse of brotherhood in error." The march on Rome, the mother's supplication, the long resistance, the final yielding of bad passions to good, whichever must be the case in a nature worthy the epithet of noble, the rage of Aufidius at what he considered his ally's weakness, the death of Coriolanus, the final sorrow of his great enemy, all scenes made of condensed truth and strength came on in succession and carried with them in their deep, fast flow the heart and mind of reader and listener. "Now, have you felt Shakespeare?" asked Caroline, some 10 minutes after her cousin had closed the book.
"I think so."
"And have you felt anything in Coriolanus like you?"
"Perhaps I have."
"Was he not faulty as well as great?"
Moore nodded.
"And what was his fault? What made him hated by the citizens? What caused him to be banished by his countrymen? What do you think it was?"
"I ask again.
Whether was it pride, which out of daily fortune ever taints the happy man? Whether defect of judgment, to fail in the disposing of those chances which he was lord of? Or whether nature, not to be other than one thing, not moving from the cask to the cushion, but commanding peace even with the same austerity and garb as he controlled the war?"
"Well, answer yourself, Sphinx."
"It was a spice of all, and you must not be proud to your work people, you must not neglect chances of soothing them, and you must not be of an inflexible nature, uttering a request as austerely as if it were a command. That is the moral you tack to the play. What puts such notions into your head? A wish for your good, a care for your safety, dear Robert, and a fear, caused by many things which I have heard lately, that you will come to harm."
"Who tells you these things?"
"I hear my uncle talk about you. He praises your hard spirit, your determined cast of mind, your scorn of low enemies, your resolution not to truckle to the mob, as he says."
"And would you have me truckle to them?"
"No, not for the world. I never wish you to lower yourself, but somehow I cannot help thinking it unjust to include all poor working people under the general and insulting name of the mob, and continually to think of them and treat them haughtily."
"You are a little democrat, Caroline. If your uncle knew, what would he say?"
"I rarely talk to my uncle, as you know, and never about such things. He thinks everything but sewing and cooking above women's comprehension, and out of their line."
"And do you fancy you comprehend the subjects on which you advise me?"
"As far as they concern you, I comprehend them. I know it would be better for you to be loved by your workpeople than to be hated by them, and I am sure that kindness is more likely to win their regard than pride. If you were proud and cold to me in Hortense, should we love you? When you are cold to me, as you are sometimes, can I venture to be affectionate in return? Now, Lena, I've had my lesson both in languages and ethics, with a touch on politics, it is your turn. Hortense tells me you were much taken by a little piece of poetry you learned the other day, a piece by poor André Chenier, La Jeune Captive. Do you remember it still?"
"I think so."
"Repeat it, then. Take your time and mind your accent, especially let us have no English use." Caroline, beginning in a low, rather tremulous voice, but gaining courage as she proceeded, repeated the sweet verses of Chenier. The last three stanzas she rehearsed well. "Mon beau voyage encore est si loin de sa fin. J'ai pars, et d'ailleurs mot qui borde le chemin j'ai passé la première à peine. Au banquet de la vie à peine commence, un instant sur mon mes lèvres en presse la coupe en mes mains encore plein. J'ai ni suis qu'au printemps j'ai vu voir la moisson, et comme le soleil, de saison en saison, j'ai vu achever mon année, brillante sur ma taille. Et l'honneur du jardin j'ai ne voulu rencor que les fous du matin, j'ai vu achever ma journée." Moore listened at first with his eyes cast down, but soon he furtively raised them. Leaning back in his chair he could watch Caroline without her perceiving where his gaze was fixed. Her cheek had a color, her eyes alight, her countenance an expression this evening which would have made even plain features striking, but there was not the grievous defect of plainness to pardon in her case. The sunshine was not shed on rough barrenness, it fell on soft bloom. Each lineament was turned with grace, the whole aspect was pleasing. At the present moment animated, interested, touched she might be called beautiful.
Such a face was calculated to awaken not only the calm sentiment of esteem, the distant one of admiration, but some feeling more tender, genial, intimate friendship, perhaps, affection, interest. When she had finished, she turned to Moore, and met his eye. "Is that pretty well repeated?" she inquired, smiling like any happy, docile child.
"I really don't know."
"Why don't you know? Have you not listened?"
"Yes, and looked. You are fond of poetry, Lena?"
"When I meet with real poetry, I cannot rest till I have learned it by heart, and so made it partly mine."
Mr. Moore now sat silent for several minutes. It struck 9 o'clock. Sarah entered, and said that Mr. Helstone's servant was come for Miss Caroline.
"Then the evening is gone already," she observed, "and it will be long, I suppose, before I pass another here."
Hortense had been for some time nodding over her knitting, fallen into a doze now. She made no response to the remark.
"You would have no objection to come here oftener of an evening?" inquired Robert, as he took her folded mantle from the side table, where it still lay, and carefully wrapped it round her.
"I like to come here, but I have no desire to be intrusive. I am not hinting to be asked, you must understand that."
"Oh, I understand thee, child. You sometimes lecture me for wishing to be rich, Lena, but if I were rich, you should live here always at any rate, you should live with me wherever my habitation might be.
That would be pleasant, and if you were poor ever so poor it would still be pleasant. Good night, Robert.
I promised to walk with you up to the rectory."
"I know you did, but I thought you had forgotten, and I hardly knew how to remind you, though I wished to do it. But would you like to go? It is a cold night, and as Fanny has come, there is no necessity.
Here is your muff, don't wake Hortense come."
The half mile to the rectory was soon traversed. They parted in the garden without kiss, scarcely with the pressure of hands, yet Robert sent his cousin in excited and joyously troubled. He had been singularly kind to her that day, not in phrase, compliment, profession, but in manner, in look, and in soft and friendly tones. For himself, he came home grave, almost morose. As he stood leaning on his own yard gate, musing in the watery moonlight all alone, the hushed, dark mill before him, the hill environed hollow round, he exclaimed, abruptly, "Dash! This won't do. There's weakness, this downright ruining all this. However," he added, dropping his voice, "the frenzy is quite temporary. I know it very well, I have had it before. It will be gone tomorrow." Chapter 7. The Curates at Tea. Caroline Helstone was just 18 years old, and at 18 the true narrative of life is yet to be commenced. Before that time we sit listening to a tale, a marvelous fiction, delightful sometimes, and sad sometimes, almost always unreal. Before that time our world is heroic, its inhabitants half divine or semi-demon, its scenes are dream scenes, darker woods and stranger hills, brighter skies, more dangerous waters, sweeter flowers, more tempting fruits, wider plains, drearier deserts, sunnier fields than are found in nature, overspread our enchanted globe. What a moon we gaze on before that time! How the trembling of our hearts at her aspect bears witness to its unutterable beauty! As to our sun, it is a burning heaven, the world of gods. At that time, at 18, drawing near the confines of elusive, void dreams, elfland lies behind us, the shores of reality rise in front. These shores are yet distant, they look so blue, soft, gentle, we long to reach them. In sunshine we see a greenness beneath the azure, as of spring meadows, we catch glimpses of silver lines, and imagine the roll of living waters. Could we but reach this land, we think to hunger and thirst no more, whereas many a wilderness, and often the flood of death, or some stream of sorrow as cold and almost as black as death, is to be crossed ere true bliss can be tasted. Every joy that life gives must be earned ere it is secured, and how hardly earned, those only know who have wrestled for great prizes. The heart's blood must gem with red beads the brow of the combatant, before the wreath of victory rustles over it. At 18 we are not aware of this. Hope, when she smiles on us, and promises happiness tomorrow, is implicitly believed. Love, when he comes wandering like a lost angel to our door, is at once admitted, welcomed, embraced. His quiver is not seen, if his arrows penetrate, their wound is like a thrill of new life. There are no fears of poison, none of the barb which no leech's hand can extract. That perilous passion and agony ever in some of its faces, with many, an agony throughout is believed to be an unqualified good. In short, at 18 the school of experience is to be entered, and her humbling, crushing, grinding, but yet purifying and invigorating lessons are yet to be learned. Alas, experience. No other mentor has so wasted and frozen a face as yours. None wears a robe so black, none bears a rod so heavy, none with hand so inexorable draws the novice so sternly to his task, and forces him with authority so resistless to its acquirement. It is by your instructions alone that man or woman can ever find a safe track through life's wilds. Without it, how they stumble, how they stray. On what forbidden grounds do they intrude, down what dread declivities are they hurled? Caroline, having been convoyed home by Robert, had no wish to pass what remained of the evening with her uncle. The room in which he sat was very sacred ground to her, she seldom intruded on it, and tonight she kept aloof till the bell rang for prayers. Part of the evening church service was the form of worship observed in Mr. Helstone's household. He read it in his usual nasal voice, clear, loud, and monotonous. The rite over, his niece, according to her wont, stepped up to him. Good night, uncle. Hey. You've been gadding abroad all day visiting, dining out, and what not. Only at the cottage. And have you learned your lessons?
Yes.
And made a shirt?
Only part of one.
Well, that will do. Stick to the needle, learn shirt making and gown making and pie crust making, and you'll be a clever woman someday. Go to bed now. I'm busy with a pamphlet here. Presently the niece was enclosed in her small bedroom, the door bolted, her white dressing gown assumed, her long hair loosened and falling thick, soft, and wavy to her waist, and as, resting from the task of combing it out.